All right, hello and welcome to the City on Fire commentary for Year of the Dragon. This is the Jizzer, and I'm with...
MPL.
Okay. Okay, Jeff, when was the first time you seen this movie?
I saw it... Actually, I saw the trailer back in 85, and I didn't see the movie till my aunt rented it for me.
Right. Maybe
a year later, when it came, when it debuted on video.
Is that the trailer that's on the DVD?
No, the trailer I remember on the DVD was different. It started out, with some footnotes, from the director of Year of the Dragon, or from the director of The Deer Hunter comes Year of the Dragon, and it had Mickey Rourke, pushing some Chinese guy to the bar.
Right, yeah.
He just had some, just beating up a Chinese guy.
Right.
I've seen the first movie we'll see here.
Yeah, because basically...
And it looked intriguing when I saw it on TV, and I really wanted to see it. It just looked, there was just something about it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I'd heard about it a while back when I was, browsing through Blockbuster Video, and I kind of picked up the video case, and it had, Mickey Rourke on the front with a gun sort of leaning over Irene with a firing, and I kind of...
Oh, yeah, okay, that's your cover.
Yeah, and it was really kind of I remember thinking, what the hell is this film? Because it would have been, 1985, and I'd seen most of the movies all that time, and it was kind of who's this by? And you, read the back cover, and you're like, wow, the guy made a deal on there. Nice one.
Uh-huh.
A blogger wrote, Oliver Stone wrote it. You're like, wow. And then, but it was I didn't really rent videos them days. I kind of just bought stuff, and it wasn't available to buy, so it kind of went under the...
Exactly, Well, you could buy it, but you just had to be ready to pay, $500?
Well, yes and no, but I mean, you literally, it was out on video, but it was you had to track it down, hunt it down to get it. It wasn't you couldn't go into HMV and pick it up. And, with it being, a scope movie, a widescreen movie, it was kind of, I wouldn't buy a pan and scan version of it anyway, so it's kind of forget about it. Anyway, then...
I was born watching the pan and scan version.
Exactly, and then when my interest kind of came back into it, it was basically when you did the site, and you'd kind of done in 2000, you did, a homage to it, didn't you? For the...
Yeah, I did, because I was obsessed with the movie by the time late 97, I became obsessed with the movie, and, about that time, 2000, I ordered a press kit from eBay, and, got a lot of cool shots.
Yeah.
And even for the site, because I thought those guys were really cool looking.
Yeah, because
even if they're wearing members only jackets, they were still cool looking.
Yeah, the first time I came to the site, and then the photographs of the punk, punk triads, I actually thought that they were the guys from the site. I was thinking, is that MPM? For months. And
If I look like that, I would not.
It's kind of cool. I was thinking, hang on. And then it wasn't until you did the Year of the Dragon, one, when it was 2000. You said celebrating the Year of the Dragon, not the year of the movie.
When I was designing it, I had no idea it was the Year of the Dragon, so I just kind of added that in. What are we seeing right now on the screen here?
Right, we're getting the opening the celebration for the Year of the Dragon. I assume that's what they're celebrating. All the fireworks going off and stuff.
Of course. Oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, we've kind of talked through the credits, but what's your take on the credits for this sort of film? Because they don't tend to do credits like this these days. They're kind of there's a good 3 minutes of just a black screen with, text. And, they used to do them all the time for, movies, and I kind of like it because it kind of takes you, if you're sitting in a theater watching the movie, it kind of, you've had all the trailers blasted at you, all the adverts and stuff. And then it gives you time to kind of get in the mood of the movie, and the music kind of brings you into it.
Well, the music for this credit sequence kind of takes over. I mean, the black and then the really haunting, Chinese-sounding music puts you in the mood.
Well, yeah, Simone used the same sort of credits for Deer Hunter as well, but obviously different music, just kind of the standard text on thing. He didn't do the same for Sicilian, but he used the same font. He's got this Michael
Simon. Oh, he used the same font,
Simone font that he uses, the same
exactly.
He uses the same stuff from Woody Allen and all that. Okay, right.
I would just like to point out that these scenes, even though they're supposed to take place in Mott Street, Chinatown, New York, but they were actually filmed in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yeah, I read that too.
At the time this was filming, at the time back in 85, it was nearly impossible to film a Chinese parade, a Chinese funeral in New York.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just too busy to do that. I mean, nowadays, with the big budgets they have, they can close streets down, but back then, they couldn't do it. I mean, even a Michael Cimino film couldn't do it.
Yeah, it's pretty...
So they pretty much build blocks and blocks of these Chinatown-looking sets and just did it from there, and they did a really good job because you really can't tell unless I pointed it out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not being in New York, but I mean, from what I've seen in the movies and stuff, it's pretty...
Oh, yeah, it looks like New York. I haven't been in New York either, but I mean, it looks like New York.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the budget because this film was quite a high-budget movie for the time it
was. Oh, yeah,
For the type of story, you don't really get that much money to make a kind of like a standard like detective sort of like number one this sort of movie. And the amount of money they spent on this as far as production values. I mean, personally, mm-hmm. from my point of view, I only seen this like about a month ago for the first time, and I've watched it several times since. But one thing was really impressed me about it was the fact, like, I don't know, I've seen the widescreen on DVD, but actually, like, the scope of the sort of the look of it and everything, it's just like a lot of money's being like spent on it. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Anyway, do you know this guy? You know the guy in the red jacket?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's basically. Have you seen King of New York?
Yeah, he was. Pretty much the same hair, same acting, same everything.
Yeah, like no.
And he also the same in there's another movie he plays too in the same. Oh gosh, China Girl.
Yeah,
China Girl, which is also an Abel Ferreira movie, and he plays the same type of character again.
Yeah, Jewish.
And Arian, the model, she's also in. She makes a cameo appearance in King of New York also.
Yeah, what do you know? What is that? I remember I've got the thing on video, but I never got a chance to get around to watching it to find out exactly where she appears.
It's a really short scene, thank God, and it's like towards the end of the movie, she's just talking. I mean, it goes by like in 2 minutes. I don't even know why they even credited her. She's almost an extra.
Mm.
I mean, she has a small speaking part.
I think she gets a special thanks credit after Madafla, actually.
Yeah. Like, this scene right here is kind of cliched. You know, it's got the whole,
I actually really like
that. Money.
Yeah, I actually really like that scene when I first seen it because it's kind of really kind of like, balls out, sort of when the fucking guy's head comes
off. Straight to the point, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, whoa, what's going on here? You know what I mean? It's kind of like.
Instead of doing this, like, right, I mean, during the funeral sequence, too.
Yeah, they're just, like, in the cutting, it's kind of like going around whacking out all the.
And then they introduce Stanley White, played by Mickey Rourke.
Yep, and here he comes. What's his take on his haircut? Because obviously he's playing a character that was much older than himself. I mean, he was about. He was born in 53, this is mid 80s, so he was born, like, he's about. Coming up 41 when he did the role, but I think his kind of character needs to be a lot older, and it's kind of because the thing I mentioned about earlier when I first seen the picture of the box, it was basically a picture of Mickey Rourke, and it was a black and white still like kind of picture, and his hair was really grey, and I remember because I wasn't like a big fan of Rourke at the time, so I hadn't watched many of his movies, and the thing is with Mickey Rourke, every movie you see him in, he kind of looks completely different from the last role.
Oh yeah, he looks especially now that he doesn't have a face.
Oh right, yeah.
Cheekbones, I mean.
I'll go into that in more detail later on the movie sort of thing. I've got a big sort of thing about Mickey Rourke's kind of appearance. But just to mention the hair, because the first time you see him in this, you kind of see him from the back, and you wouldn't recognize it as Mickey Rourke because of this kind of.
Oh yeah, exactly. But yeah. If you didn't know he was Mickey Rourke, there's no way you'd want to watch this guy. I mean, it's just some guy with big white hair.
Yeah, I think the way it's shot sort of thing, you know what I mean? Like, people have noticed that his hair kind of changes colour, so to speak, between scenes.
Yeah.
But I don't think it necessarily does. It's just the fact that, like, you know what I mean, when you're sort of outdoors and that, and you've got, like, natural light on your hair, and then obviously you've got it tinted to look grey, and when you're interior, it looks kind of slightly different, but the way it's kind of shot on film, it kind of looks just completely, like, really, like, erratic differences, and it's kind of like...
Yeah.
It kind of, like, a lot of critics kind of pointed out, like, it was kind of like a... emotive hair. The hair was kind of changing color depending on what sort of mood he was.
I'd read about it, about some of the stuff you said about the hair changing color, but I never even noticed it until
ago. The thing is, when you mentioned this movie to me in 2000, I like to say I only watched it a month ago, so I've had like 3 years basically of like kind of reading about it, keeping an eye out on all like the TV broadcasts, looking to see if it was popping up in the cinema, and just like getting as much information on it as possible, just kind of like some really like piqued interest in it. So kind of, I like read more about it than when I finally watched it. The first time I watched it, it was kind of like, right, I've finally seen it now, and it was kind of like a bit underwhelming, you know what I mean? It wasn't like until I watched it a couple of times, I kind of really kind of appreciated it, you know what I mean? But yeah, anyway, he's John Lone as well.
Yeah, John Lone, who was actually nominated for, he was nominated for Best Performance for this movie. Of course, he lost.
Yeah, what was this for? It wasn't an Oscar, was it? Because it completely died, bombed for the critics as well as the box office when it came out.
Yeah, it did. And people had their hopes up. I mean, this was Michael Camino's last straw, especially after...
Well, it was his comeback.
He did Deer Hunter, which was, he was on top of the world when he did Deer Hunter. And then he did Heaven's Gate, you know, the first high-budget movie to really flop. And then this was his, last straw right here.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you want to do a big synopsis on... Michael Simone. Basically, the guy was kind of a writer for hire during, like, the 70s. And he kind of worked closely with Clint Eastwood and stuff, and he basically, like, wrote a couple of... Dirty Harry basically wrote Magnum Force with John Milius. And he also, he wrote, like, Silent Running. That's, like, quite a good sci-fi movie with Bruce Stern, really, like, cult movie. The other guy who wrote that was the kind of an guy who wrote NYPD Blue. Anyway, he was kind of getting, like, a lot of kudos in Hollywood for his writing. And basically he wrote this movie called Thunderbolt Lightfoot. And Clint Eastwood really, really liked it and kind of like said, well, I want to make this sort of movie. And Simone kind of said, well, there's any chance of me directing it. And with it being for Clint Eastwood's Malpasso company, he was kind of clear. He said, well, yeah, fair enough. And so basically, Cimino's first major movie, kind of a big budget Hollywood like movie, you know what I mean? With Stan Clint Eastwood, like, in like 71.
So Clint Eastwood is kind of... He kind of got his career boosted in a way.
Definitely. And then after he'd made that sort of thing, you know what I mean? Next minute, he made The Deer Hunter. And then, like, the critics kind of fell over themselves, kind of praising that, and the box office grew on it. And it's kind of like, you know what I mean, one fucking, like, about 7-8 Oscars, isn't it? Like, one best picture and one best director. And this is, like, Cimino on his second movie. So then after that, was basically, this was kind of like when the director was king in Hollywood. And they kind of, like, said, right, okay, then, and United Artists. Kind of said, oh, well, what do you want to make next? And he was going, oh, well, I want to make this movie called The Johnson County Wars based on this, like, book. And they were like, okay, then. So they gave him, like, money, more money than God, and just threw money at him. He just kind of went berserk, and he just shot fucking tons and tons of footage and printed every scene and just kind of went on and on and on. It ran over budget. And basically, by the time it was kind of coming out, it was one of them where it was like a make-or-break company job, same way Titanic was. I mean, if Titanic hadn't made a lot of money for 20th Century Fox, they killed him. They were like, outsourcing it to Paramount. Anyway, back to Heaven's Gate. Heaven's Gate came out and it completely died. It got pulled off the cinemas after about 3 fucking days and they cut the shit out of it. And it was long.
It was a long movie too.
Yeah, it was about 3.5 hours. But they played it for 3.5 hours, but it kind of bombed at that sort of thing. People didn't like it. So then they cut the shit out of it and then it just kind of died and they were like, well, fuck, we can't get our money back on this. We spent like, you know what I mean, obscene amount of money on it. And then after that fiasco, no fucker touched him with a shitty stick. Because he'd spent that much money and, like, bankrupt the whole United Arts company.
Studios didn't want to touch the guy.
MGM had to buy the fuckers out. So that was that. And then this was, like, then 5 years later, this was, like, his first movie since then, which was, like, you know what I mean, kind of his comeback.
And he was still, even when this movie came out, he was still, I mean, despite, you know, the whole Heaven's Gate fiasco, he was still a really respected filmmaker. I mean, I remember Asian community was really big on this movie. I mean, you know, despite how it portrays them in this really, you know, sinister way.
Yeah.
I remember it was a really big thing for Asians in this movie because, you know, Asians were looking at this movie as a high budget. This is the guy that did The Deer Hunter, man. He's making a movie about Asians.
Yeah, I know, but...
And that's funny. If you see all the Asians in this movie, man, they're like, they're at top notch, dude. Every Asian in this movie, I mean, except the reporter, is treating this as, like, this is going to be a great movie, so let's give it our all. Look at these guys.
I mean, as far as the Asians, you've got John Lorne, who was like kind of, I mean, I don't know that much about the guy, but I mean, he made Last Emperor.
Before this movie, he was really unrecognizable in a movie called Iceman.
Yeah, I read about that. He was a stick.
Yeah. He actually played an Iceman, and the guy did not look Chinese, man. He looked like an Iceman, man.
Wasn't that a stage play on New York, on Broadway? And it was kind of...
Iceman?
Yeah, and then it got made into a movie, and it was starring.
Oh, I'm not really sure. I didn't realize it was a stage play.
It
was a great movie, from what I remember, though.
Yeah, but I mean, the other guys, this guy here, the talking in the middle, Victor Wong. I mean, he's like, he's basically in Big Trouble Little China.
Yeah, Big Trouble Little China, Golden Child.
Yeah, he's in Last Emperor as well. He basically is like one of John Carpenter's guys. I mean, he's in Big Trouble Little China. He's in Prince of Darkness. Yeah. The same way
he was one of those Asian guys that could speak really good English and really
every movie of this like ilk around this sort of time when they needed an Asian old guy actor.
Yeah, Asian old guy type guy, yeah.
Phone Victor Wong, you know what I mean? Came along and turned up.
Yeah, he sadly he passed away 2001, September 12th, right after like the day after 9/11.
Okay. Do you know this guy is on the right? See the guy with the glasses on?
I've never seen him before, but I think I've seen his name
I've no idea who he is, and I'm trying to find out who he is. But he looks a spitting image of, you know, Chang Cheng, or the Shaw Brothers director.
You know, I never.
But she's got the same sort of face and the kind of same sort of, I mean, not with the glasses and stuff, but the first time I like.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm.
He looks like a piece of bread.
Yeah, gladly. That's another thing. I was gonna talk about Mickey Rourke and basically the fact that every movie he seems to make, he always seems to like have something like about his character that's kind of like on the externally, he always fucks his face up or does something. Like in the scar on his nose, you know what the scar on his nose is to do with on this? Because the first time I watched this movie, it's kind of like, oh, why has he got a scar on his nose?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I kind of watched a couple of other movies, like doing research on this, kind of watched Angel Heart. And Angel Heart's got a scar on his cheek. And it's kind of like as if he's kind of like really like paranoid about his face being so like pretty or beautiful, so to speak. And he always kind of like likes to fuck things up and kind of wear like.
So he pretty much fucks himself up. You know, he wants that whole spitting bad boy image on screen, huh?
Yeah, and he always seems to do it, sort of thing. I mean, his dream role must have been Johnny Handsome because he could hide behind all the fucking prosthetic makeup. No, I mean, in that movie, he must have had a whale of a time because he was kind of like covered his face completely, you know what I mean? And then it's quite ironic that his movie's kind of after that and kind of what turned out later. He's kind of faced through all this reconstructive surgery after the boxing stuff.
Yeah.
He kind of, you know what I mean? He looked more like Johnny Hansen.
Yeah, if that's a real scar, I mean, you'd think that they would go out of their way to cover it up, but you could see Mickey Rourke actually going, no, I want to leave the scar there, you know, just don't even fuck with it.
Yeah, I know, that's what I mean, but it's not really done much in movies because. People have got such like finicky sort of. I mean, people.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Why has he got someone on his nose? Is there a scene cut where he got punched, or is there a scene cut where? And it's kind of like, I mean, whatever, man. I mean, people get scars on the nose. People get like, you know what I mean, they might fucking cut themselves shaving or something. You know what I mean, shit happens.
Yeah.
Which is kind of unusual to sort of see it with like a lead actor. I mean, the biggest one of that was we've seen Chinatown, Jack Nicholson, Roman Polanski movie. Like basically, like there's a scene in that when Jack Nicholson gets his nose slit. And wears this fucking humongous plaster over his face for like pretty much like a whole like half of the movie after he gets his nose split. It's kind of like really weird because it's kind of like, hang on, this is like your main actor in the movie, and he is like kind of his face covered by a big fucking plaster through the movie. It's like really, really ballsy, like, you know what I mean? They don't tend to do that sort of shit, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I really like this scene where he's kind of in the office, kind of like, I mean, it's a bit cliche now, it's kind of like the old kind of the.
Yeah, they show his relationship with the other workers. Yeah,
but I think this is really well done. Like, this is kind of one of my first kind of mentions is like all Vietnam background and stuff. Like, you know what I mean, he's kind of got that symbol on his tie, which obviously something to do with the Air Force, whatever it was.
Yeah,
just like
the guy he's talking to there is Ray Berry, which is from Rapid Fire, I believe.
Well, he plays a very similar role in every movie you see him in. He always seems to play this like cop.
Always a cop in suit, basically.
Yeah, I mean, he's in it's quite interesting that because the person who plays Mickey Rourke's wife in this, Caroline Carver, she's actually stars in Born on the 4th of July with Raymond Barre, and they both play Tom Cruise's parents.
I
was watching it, I was kind of like, I was thinking, where the hell have I seen this guy from? And then when Mickey Rourke's wife came in, I was thinking, hang on, that's Tom Cruise's mum in Born on the 4th of July, and I was kind of like, and then when I checked out, I was like, how funny, it's the same guy who played, like, no, he's the same parents. I mean,
he looks the same, too. The only difference is his hair just got a little bit wider.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was only made, like, what was it, 88 or something, so it was only, like, 4 years, 3 years.
Yeah, it was only, 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm.
But even in Rapid Fire, which was made 8 years ago, he looks the same.
Yeah.
Imagine him in Stanley White's role, because that's how old he's supposed to be, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't think he could pull it off.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The Rourke's performance in this is like, you know what I mean, kind of the basically carries the movie, you know what I mean? I mean, the script itself is really good, but you need someone the interest about the script, actually, because what the deal was at the time, basically, you know what I mean? Have you actually read the Robert Daly book?
No, I haven't.
Years and years ago.
Yeah, I kind of read it years ago. I tried to sit there and read it, but just never got through it.
I mean, I've spotted people who've read it myself. I was trying to get myself a copy to before doing this commentary, but it's like out of print. Can't get it for life, sort of thing. So I was like knackered. But from what I've kind of researched on it, and basically, the movie's kind of, it doesn't sort of have an, I don't think, the reporter's in it, but she's white or something. She's not Asian. No, the reporter, he falls in love with Adriana.
Yeah, the reporter is Caucasian.
Yeah, she is. So is that correct then? She is Caucasian
mm-hmm.
in the book, right? Okay.
And Oliver Stone changed some other things around. Oliver Stone made it his own. I've talked to people that actually read the book.
Yeah.
And they all say that the movie blows it away. It's blown.
Yeah, that's why I've read it. Well. It's not half as good. It's just kind
of. This is just one of those rare cases where the movie, you know, the rewritten movie for the screen is actually more entertaining and flows better than the book. Actually a really rare case.
Have you seen that movie called Prince of the City? With Sidney Lumet. It's like made in 1981 with Treat Williams. It's actually based on another Robert Daly book. And they both kind of deal with, like...
Isn't that a low-budget movie?
Not really. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I've just kind of bumped
when it. When I hear the name Treat Williams, I can't stop thinking about The Substitute Part 8.
Well, this is like 1981, so this is kind of like before, and this is like Sidney Lumet made it, like, just after, like, well, not just after Serbia, but I mean, a good couple of years after, but I mean, Pacino was originally going to play it, but he kind of felt the story was very similar to Serpico, because it's kind of about, like, this cop who's kind of on this, like, drug enforcement agency, and he kind of, like, finds out people are taking...
He thought it was same old, yeah.
Well, it's very similar to this movie kind of thing about where the drugs coming in, sort of, against Tony Small, about the internal sort of corruption of coppers rather than kind of the triads kind of bringing in heroin. But it's kind of, like, interesting... we're trying to, like, get all that, sort of see what it's like. This Robert Daly guy kind of wrote them two movies, and I'd heard the titles, but I'd, like, never actually kind of... You can't get the books anymore, they're, like, out of print.
Robert Daly's supposed to be this big, you know... Well, I don't really know that much about him, but he's big on cop novels, you know?
Like, yeah,
really,
like
pulp, known for being really, really gritty, real, you know, down to business with cop novels.
Yeah. Actually, mentioned the Oliver Stone thing. I may as well get this out of the way now. Basically, what the deal was Cimino, when he was going to make this movie, he wanted Oliver Stone to help him write the script. Because at the time of, like, 85, or when this was kind of getting pre-production before then, Oliver Stone's script for, like, Platoon was kind of floating around Hollywood. And everyone had, like, read Platoon by Oliver Stone, and it was like, this is a really great movie, we love your script for this. You know what I mean? At the time, Oliver Stone was kind of, like, the script writer of Hollywood. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
After he won the Oscar for Midnight Express. You know what I mean? And he'd be like Conan script there, Scarface script, and he like wrote a shitload of these. And this is kind of like pretty much the last sort of script writer for hire job he actually took. And he was actually took it on as a really cheap rate that he normally would take. I mean, he wrote the script for Year of the Dragon for $200,000, which is a really low price for like an Oscar-winning screenwriter. And he kind of did it as a favour to Cimino, because Cimino was a big fan of his Platoon script. And he also did it on the understanding that the producer of this, Dino De Laurentiis, would produce Platoon. So what happened is Dino De Laurentiis kind of said, well, if you write Year of the Dragon with Cimino, then I'll produce your Platoon movie. So Stone was like, oh, great. So Stone said, well, okay then. So he wrote it at the cut-right price of $2,000. Sorry, $200,000. And basically, that was the case. And then what happened is... Stone had started pre-production on Platoon, kind of flying around, like, looking for locations and stuff and spending money kind of just looking for, like, locations and kind of pre-production. And then Dino De Laurentiis kind of got cold feet and he pulled out. And, like, Oliver Stone was like, well, I've already done the pre-production sort of thing and I've spent such and such money. And Dino De Laurentiis was like, well, you can pay me the money back or I'm keeping your script for Platoon. And Stone was like, what? So basically, Oliver Stone had to kind of take him to court and kind of get his script Platoon back off Dino De Laurentiis, because it was like a massive complete fucking fiasco. Anyway, then he got his script back and then obviously produced it with other people sort of thing, and then like, knowing that the rest is history, so to speak. But like, I mean, they're kind of being sort of like bad films, because I mean, Dino De Laurentiis gets like thanks on the end of the credits for Platoon. But it's kind of like the way like Stone got like involved. But I mean,
I just noticed something. I don't mean to cut you off, but I just noticed something. I just saw it right now for the first time.
Yeah.
On one of the dresses, I saw a statue of John Wayne. I never even noticed that. But now it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, there was like a statue, like a caricature statue of John Wayne. It's to the left.
When
you get there, you might want to wind that. I thought that was kind of interesting. You know, the whole John Wayne thing.
There's actually a lot of them. I mean, there's a lot of Catholic image. I don't know if the character plays Catholic, but I mean, there's a lot of like crosses and Jesus Christ.
Oh yeah, really.
I mean, there's a lot of the opening shot when you see establishes the home. It's kind of the top of the street. There's a church, and I mean, Simone does a lot of that in his films. I mean, Deer Hunter's got
Deer Hunter's got like the whole church scene for about 3 hours. 2 hours of the whole movie takes place.
The opening wedding scene, yeah. But the Sicilian's got quite a lot of that imagery as well.
Yeah, here's one of the really comedy scenes there. You don't see a lot of it in the movie.
Well, yeah, I mean it's quite a serious movie as far as like It is really straight laced as far as like, I mean, there's not much room for comedy in it, to be fair. But I mean, it's still quite an like not a funny movie, but I mean, some of the lines that like Mickey Rourke spits. I mean, especially watching it I only watched it last month, sort of thing, 2003, and obviously because the time it was made in 1985, it got a lot of flack because of its portrayal of Asians. Like, wasn't there a disclaimer on the beginning of the video or something you said?
Yeah, in early prints of the video, there's actually a disclaimer that starts before the movie, and it says something to the matter of this film is not to not to condemn Asian Americans. I remember this when this movie came out. It was a big deal. A lot of Asian Americans were like the movie, but they were pissed off that they were portrayed in such like gangsters. I mean, every Asian person in this movie is either besides the reporter is a gangster.
I don't know why that is. I mean, these days I don't think it's caused much of a problem because the Asian.
Oh, it would have. Yeah.
Because these days the Asian like population is so well represented in its own Hong Kong movies and the own like. I mean, this was kind of made really before the big sort of boom of Hong Kong movies. I mean, obviously there have been the Bruce Lee movies and the Kung Fu boom. But, I mean, this is before, like, all the sort of, like Every Man His Dog, like, all the Hong Kong, like, non-Kung Fu movies, so to speak, kind of started hitting, like, over here. And it's interesting, it's made the similar sort of year as Big Trouble Little China. And both of them kind of dealt with, like, the Asian sort of Hong Kong culture.
Well,
and completely bombed, no matter the box office. And then, like, several years later, like, you know what I mean? And then John Woo comes out, and then Every Man His Dog is like, fall over themselves to watch Asian movies, whereas when this kind of came out, people were like, I mean, kind of, this is like ahead of its time as far as, like, the that sort of...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, catching the wave of interest.
Even the dialogue was too over the top for the time. I mean, this is,
Well, yeah, I suppose that's probably a lot to do with Oliver Stone, because, I mean, he doesn't exactly write the subtlest dialogue. But, I mean, what I quite...
He just went all out, hell dialogue, man, you know, cutting...
Yeah. I mean, what I really like...
This movie shows in Scarface.
Well, yeah, hey, well, exactly, you know what I mean? I mean, they kind of say this is kind of a, like, a lot of people say it kind of works as a sequel to Deer Hunter, in the sort of respect that, like, it's...
It does, but, I mean, it doesn't also. I don't think it does. I mean, just for the fact that, you know, the guy's a Vietnam vet.
Yeah, exactly, I know,
But, I mean, I couldn't put two on two together, you know? Yeah, two completely different.
I mean, if someone, like, if De Niro had maybe played the cop, and it could have been a bit of more sort of similarities, kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
Taxi Driver is probably a sequel to D-Hunt as well. I mean, even though it was made before.
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
No, I mean, so you can't really win.
Yeah, First Blood could be a sequel to Deer Hunter, you know?
Well, yeah, again, he sort of Vietnam vet coming back and kind of times and
stuff. Okay, tell us about what's the song playing here?
I think you're best off telling me that, because in every goddamn Hong Kong movie, isn't it? Like, it must be a...
Well, you actually know the title, because that MP3 you sent actually had the title. It's called Dream Dance.
Oh, right, well, yeah, I know.
And it's some kind of, how do I say it?
Is it like a folk song, a Chinese
song? Yeah, it's like a folk song. Yeah, you hear it a lot. I mean, the first time I heard it was in this movie, and I started hearing it little by little. You could hear it in Rush Hour 2.
Yeah, it's in Corruptor as well, is it? Did you say it was in Corruptor?
Yeah, it's been in a lot of loads of Hong Kong movies, too. Yeah, it's in Corruptor. A
couple of Maggie Chung movies.
Yeah, some Maggie Chung movies, so it's heard a lot.
It must be like a kind of a folk song, kind of like a Chinese folk song.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you think's actually getting whacked? Do you know when the Chinese guys come in here to shoot? Because they're not, like, when I watched it with friends, and friends were actually thinking they were coming in to kill Mickey Rourke, which I don't think's the case. No, I mean, I think there's some other...
I think they were trying to whack this guy. I mean, they weren't going to try to whack him, but they wanted to look like they were whacking Victor Wong.
That's what I thought, but I'm thinking, Victor Wong's got his own little kind of gangs, like the same way John Bond's using these guys. I think Victor Wong's got his own, like, little triad members.
Yeah.
They're going to kill the little tribe members, because if you watch when they go in here, these guys here, you see them walking in, and the guy in the car is looking at them. They're the guys they're going to whack, because if you go in here and you watch it, the people who've got guns in the scene and are getting shot, shooting back, returning fire, are like other sort of triads. And I think it's kind of John Lone kind of getting rid of Victor Wong's kind of henchmen with his henchmen. Because if you notice, they don't go in to kill Victor Wong, they just kind of like knock him out. I mean, when they hit him with the butt of the gun when they're running, don't they?
That makes a lot of sense, actually. They're definitely not there to kill Mickey Rourke. But I always thought, I mean, as good as the scene is, I thought it was like just a really big coincidence that the reporter's there, that Mickey Rourke's there, and, you know.
Yeah,
just the coincidence, everyone's there, you know.
Isn't this in the book?
And right when they're talking about it, too.
Yeah. Isn't the book actually this? It starts with this scene. The opening scene.
Yeah, the book starts out with the scene.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah,
I'm this scene right here is actually based on a real event that happened in San Francisco at I think it was the Golden Gate Palace Chinese restaurant, late 70s, San Francisco. There was a similar massacre, and this was kind of based off it. Robert Daly based off that.
Yeah. It's actually quite interesting, because when you read reviews of this movie, they kind of say, like, they mention, like, this, like, restaurant scene, the shootout, and they kind of say it's, like, Sam Peckinpah-esque violence and this and that. And,
yeah.
And it wasn't until I kind of watched it a couple of times, I thought, well, it isn't necessarily Sam Peckinpah violence. I mean, there's not a lot of slow-mo in it and stuff. It's just kind of, like, really sort of ballsy. But then when I realized that all the reviews I was reading were kind of that time, and in, like, 1985, Sam Peckinpah was still kind of, like, the name that was attached to all, like, action scenes. Whereas these days, John Woo gets attached to
it. John Woo hasn't even been there tomorrow yet.
Regardless of whether the action scene is anything like a John Woo scene, they always say John Woo action, because it just means good action.
I think it's another one of those things that's kind of ahead of its time as far as this scene. You mean Quentin Tarantino, in one of the books I've read, he called it one of his favorite shootout scenes.
Yeah, I caught that. It's called Quentin Tarantino.
And if you think about it, like, especially towards the end of the massacre, you know, the part where they gunned down the aquarium.
Yeah, well,
that's
it's
something
just
they didn't start doing from the 90s. Yeah.
You don't see that sort of violence.
So I think that part kind of makes the whole shoot scene worthwhile, you know, because it's really not that great of a shoot scene.
But just the innocent
the scope of it, too, you know, those two guys running up the stairs was pretty tough. But it's kind of a messy, I mean, for the time it was pretty good, I mean, but overall I think it's messy, you know.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case.
It reminds me a lot of that Scarface shoot-up, you know, the Diaz brothers.
Yeah, well, yeah, but the thing is, in the Scarface shootout, they managed to shoot everyone but anyone, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's funny.
We're going to get the targets where these guys, they take out the fucking, you know what I mean, they hit the guys, they're the guys are dead.
A couple of guys are dead.
They've shot out the thing, so they've done their good job. The only thing he doesn't do is he fucks up and shoots himself in the foot. That's probably where the Peckinpah reference, because that happens in Straw Dogs, a guy kind of shoots himself in the foot. Like, you know what I mean? It looks exactly like that, but anyway.
Yeah, you never see that in regular, you know, Western movies, unless it's, you know, tongue-in-cheek humor, you know, ooh, I shot my foot.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a really good scene, but the thing is, when I first watched this, like, people had been reviewing stuff, and, like, a lot of people kind of mentioned saying, oh, it wasn't that good a scene, and it wasn't, and I was kind of like, whatever, and the first time I watched it was, like, you know, I mean, just, like, on my fucking laptop, or, like, at home, so it was, like, obviously tiny sort of screen stuff, and it's sort of, like, a really widescreen movie sort of thing, and it was kind of, like, it was a good scene, but I wasn't, like, really, like, blown away by anything, and it wasn't until like a couple of like weeks later I watched it at home on widescreen TV, like in 5.1 surround sound, and I was really really sucked in. I was like, holy shit, when like everything kicked off in the restaurant, wow, you know what I mean, it really is an effective scene sort of thing, you know what I mean. It's not a scene you can kind of watch out of context, don't think. You couldn't like show your friend it and say, watch this shootout, and it'll go, wow, that's great.
You actually got to look for the details to appreciate it, basically.
Yeah, exactly, you know what I mean, it's kind of like a really kind of good scene. But I think it's in like modern audiences, kind of everything has to work out of context. You know what I mean? You have to watch a scene, like, you know I mean, stuff like The Matrix, you watch like a fucking scene of it and it'll look really, really good. It doesn't necessarily mean the film's good, it's because everything works on a sort of individual scene basis, where this is kind of like, this is a fucking movie, you have to actually sit down and watch, kind of appreciate everything.
And he kisses her, man. And this is the part where she gives in, you know, she's like, Dan, you're right, I'm working with you.
Yeah. I mean, it got criticized a lot because of the sort of the relationship between like the characters. I mean, I must admit, when I first watched this, I don't know if you read the review or wrote it, but I really did not like Adriani's performance in it.
And that's the thing. And every time we read reviews, people actually go out of their way to say she's bad. I mean, usually when there's bad actors, actresses, people spend whole paragraphs on this lady, you know, talking about how bad her acting.
Yeah, and I actually went in watching the movie with like really kind of low expectations, thinking, well, I won't do that. And then when I got the review of it, I was kind of thinking, well, I'm still going to...
Yeah, you're like, oh, man.
Yeah, you know what I mean? But then, I've been watching it a couple more times since then. I'm not so much, like bothered by the performance. It kind of it blends in a bit more. But when I first watched the movie, it stands out a lot against the other actors. Because John Lone's performance in it is, like, really, really cool. John Lone in this is, like, a kind of wolf in sheep's clothing, like, really sort of slick. I mean, he's like, you mentioned he was, like, chilling with fat types coolness, and he is. And Mickey Rourke in it is just kind of like really sort of awesome sort of performance as well. And
yeah, really, really a good contrasting form.
Yeah, and Adriani, sandwiched in the middle, it kind of, she just stands out like a sore thumb. But when you've watched this movie a couple more times and you kind of get used to the actors and stuff, she doesn't stand out as much because you're kind of used to it, you're expecting it, so it's kind of like, oh, right, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Ariane was actually about the time this film came out. If you have like an old Vogue magazine or actually any kind of model magazine back in 84, 85, she was all over the cover. She was big.
The big like Asian face. Like.
Yeah, I remember my sister used to be in the supermodels and she used to hang all these posters up of supermodels and there was one spread that came in a Vogue magazine and at the time it had a picture of all the top models and, you know, Cindy Crawford was in there, Paulina Porizkova was in there. Christie Brinkley was in there, and also Ariane was in there. She was like a big Asian thing.
All right.
She was like Armani. She was like Armani's best model for showcasing his, you know, his wardrobes and stuff.
Yeah, because I mean,
I think she was only 21 when she did this movie, so she was straight off the runways to this movie.
Yeah, and then she went straight back. One zoom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, went straight back, which is, you know, very likely for a model. I mean, look at any model's career.
Yeah. Well, I mean.
Or any woman's career.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, Cindy Crawford did the same thing, did one movie and then vanished.
And she also, yeah, exactly. And Ariane also, prior to, you know, to filming this movie, she, Michael Cimino sent her to work with CBS. She spent months and months working with
CBS. You know what? It's interesting you mention that because one of the things about performance is that when she's actually performing to the camera in within the movie, she's a really good actress because she kind of like, you know, I mean, she delivers the lines how you'd expect to hear them on the news. But that's the problem I had with the performance is that she tends to talk to everyone with that sort of monotone.
Exactly, yeah. No matter who she's talking to, it seems like she's reporting.
That's what I mean. And now you've mentioned that, it's kind of...
And I think she spent way too much time with CVS for that matter.
Yeah, it makes sense. She's kind of like...
They kind of brainwashed her, what's that one Stanley Kubrick movie? I can't even think of it. Yeah, Clockwork Orange, they just made her watch, you know, CBS newscasts all day long, man, and all of a sudden she's talking to everybody like that.
Exactly. It's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's just kind of like...
Yeah, when she has the mic, it's fine. It works well. But, you know, when she's talking to someone else, it's like, you know...
Yeah.
She's got that same monotone voice.
This scene here we're watching, this is quite a brave scene for a Hollywood movie. You very rarely get a movie in a Hollywood... A scene in a Hollywood movie that is subtitled for, like, a good, like... this is subtitled for about a good, like, 6 minutes. And it's really good the way Stone wrote it, because he must have wrote it, and he must have been aware of this. It's kind of like... I mean, because he kind of breaks into English at some point, doesn't he? Kind of delivers.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
It's quite interesting, because the second time I watched this, I was watching it on my DVD player, and I would have been region 3 in my multi-region thing. I hadn't kind of got it cracked quite yet. And this, well, I was having to watch it. I couldn't watch it with subtitles the second time I watched it. So I was actually watching it without subtitles, and you kind of... All the stuff that gets mentioned in that, it kind of just gets summarized in the actual English bit.
Yeah.
It's as if kind of Oliver Stone and Simone kind of written it, like... all the kind of details and put the main ones in English, you know what I mean? As if to say, like, you don't really need to know these stuff, but it's kind of like, interesting if you want to know. So it's quite well done.
On the other hand, the English subtitling on this DVD, it also subtitles a lot that's not subtitled, you know, on earlier cassette versions.
Yeah, well, you know what, I don't know what the deal is as far as, like, I mean, I'm not going to go into the big, like, if you go to any of the Asian forum stuff, there's always people whinging about the subtitles getting translated on Asian DVDs and whether they're literal translations or whatever. I mean, I'm not going to go into all that. But as far as this being a Hong Kong DVD, even though it's an MGM disc and stuff, the subtitles are really well done. I mean, I'm going through them here with the subtitles on for the whole movie sort of thing, but we normally would just go through with the subtitles for the Chinese, the Cantonese dialogue. And they seem well done, other than the scene where, do you know, I'll speak to you when we get to it, basically the bit when... Well, I'll tell you about when we get there, but you'll know the scene when we get there.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of like, well, we've got to pace ourselves here, man. We're only like 40 minutes in. I mean, if we kind of we talk too much about...
We're talking in and around things other than the bottom right now.
Exactly.
Man.
You can't win. People will be listening thinking, well, I wish they'd stick to the point, or they'll be thinking, I wish they don't, so you can't really win. I mean, I hate it when people tell you exactly what's happening on the screen.
Okay, what's up? Let me ask you something. What's up with that guy in the background? That guy's like in every scene of the movie when the cops are talking, but he never says one damn thing.
Why does he get called against some of the Sphinx? Mickey Rourke slags him off in a minute. Like, I mean, a nice talking to you, it's like one hand clapping. And then when he's like...
That's right, and I think he's talking about his whole performance, man.
Yeah, exactly. No, he clusters. Yeah, man.
You gotta love the dialogue of it. I mean, that's what does the movie for me, the dialogue.
Yeah.
He's putting up a hard-on for Mickey Rourke, which I do, but the dialogue of this movie is just classic, man.
Definitely. Well, I know. I think that's down to like Oliver Stone. To be honest with you, I mean,
the way Mickey Rourke, you know, says it too. I mean, the way he goes about saying the dialogue. I mean, it's just classic, man.
Yeah, I mean, even the dialogue that isn't spitting out by Mickey Rourke, like, is really good dialogue. I mean, John Lone's dialogue is really good as well. I mean, it's just a really kind of cool movie. It's interesting with his dad. Mention Mickey Rock's like role where he kind of goes and acts and puts scars on his face and stuff, because he wears a hat a lot in this movie.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that too, They really make it a point to make him look like a really,
Yeah, I mean...
down to business detective,
Because these days, they'll be like, alright, can you get the hat off, Mickey? Can you do this? I mean, we don't want a hat wearing you, and don't this, don't. It's kind of like, he's like, fuck him, you know what I mean? He's in the character, you know what I mean? He's not bothered.
Yeah.
But whether it looks a cool, a hat or something, you know what I mean? He's just kind of, his character wear that.
Oh, he was, at this time, Mickey Rourke was pretty much a trendsetter, man, so he could wear a damn...
Well,
you wear a red members only jacket, people.
Well, that's the thing, this movie was kind of like his big sort of launch, because he kind of, it popped up on the radar of Hollywood, kind of in little bit parts. He'd been in Shimoni's Heaven's Gate, he was actually in. He was, like, in a tiny role in that. And then, like, he was in a couple of other movies around the sort of time. Body Heat, he played the role in Body Heat. And then he was in a film called The Pope of Greenwich Village. And that was actually, I think it was directed by Stuart Rosenberg, the guy who made Cold Hand Luke. But I think Michael Cimino kind of ghost-directed.
Yeah, ghost-directed.
Yeah, kind of like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I read about that.
Because you mentioned his name in Hollywood around that time, it was kind of like, oh. So like, I think he kind of worked his way back in from that. But I think it was working with Mickey Rourke in there kind of like inspired him to cast him for the Year of the Dragon.
Exactly. You hear the music playing?
Yeah, that's what was that? You said it was.
That's what I was saying. Yeah, this is actually it's Rod Stewart.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I cannot picture a bunch of Asian gangsters listening to Rod Stewart.
But if you look here, the switch it off is on. It's on the radio. It's very interesting because I watched this movie with a couple of friends who were like big like 80s phobes that don't like 80s music, and I was kind of like, it's made in 1985, and they were like, it's the same year To Live and Die in LA is made, and I kind of like they made a big point of not liking the music, and that really pissed me off.
Yeah,
so I was kind of like, well,
did you see Bruce Lee right there?
On the wall, yeah, yeah.
See, that's the first time I noticed it. Right, watching it right now, I never noticed that before.
Well, yeah, you wouldn't see that in the pan and scan version, would you? Because it'd be.
Yeah, see, I'm still used to watching. Yeah, I'm still used to watching. I mean, that's just giving me more reason to notice it, you know?
Yeah. But you tell
me. I like all the blood on the bed.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. You'd think he'd have took his shoe off and at least, it's bandages up or something. You know what I mean? It's kind of like he's been shot in the foot and he's kind of just like lying on the bed going, I has. I mean, he's like, come on, man, get your fucking shoe off, get your fucking foot bandaged, see what you're doing, you know what I mean? But you can tell he's fucked here, like, you know what I mean? He's doing his John Lone Walk. It's like, right, okay, clear these fuckers out, kill him. Yeah. I mean, I think I'll really like.
You know something's up here.
The what?
You know something's up here, when John Lone pays a visit to the house.
Oh, right, yeah, definitely.
Or to the pad, whatever this place is. It's got to be the most scummiest apartment I've ever seen in your life.
Yeah. But it's interesting that they mentioned the Bruce Lee post on the wall, because the countless movies got Bruce Lee references in, be it like posters on the walls and stuff. I mean, the one on the door there, when you mentioned it, when I first seen it, reminded me of La Haine, this French movie where there's kind of a Bruce Lee poster on the door, and it's done the same way where the camera kind of opens the door and you kind of get a glimpse of it, but you're not really sure where it's at. It's kind of like, oh, anyway. It's very similar sort of.
This is like some Deer Hunter. This is actually a lot similar to what's that? John Woo movie, Bullet in the Head.
Yeah.
Forcing the guy. They look at the guy. The guy's like scared shitless, but they're forcing him to kill him.
Actually, now you mention that, it very, very is similar to Deer Hunter. I'm sorry, Bullet.
Yeah, this guy Herbert, the guy that plays Herbert,
Dennis Dunn.
Yeah, I forgot the guy's name. Oh, Dennis
Dunn.
Yeah, he was one of the main characters.
He's another John Carpenter guy. He pretty much plays the lead role in Big Trouble Little China. I mean, people tell it's Kurt Russell, but isn't it? It's Dennis Dunn. And he's also in Prince of Darkness. And surprisingly enough, he's in Last Emperor as well. I mean, there's the three of them, Dennis Dunn, Victor Wong, and John Lone. They're kind of like, I mean, they've been like holding
the same. Yeah, they use the same. I'm surprised John Lone was in somewhere in Year of the Dragon. Or Big Trouble Little China.
No, he wasn't, I don't think.
I think that movie was too cokey for him.
Well, no, it was kind of like at that time, John Lone kind of made the, Last Emperor.
The actor's list. He was...
Yeah, and then he kind of...
He had no time to do John Carpenter movies, he was a big time. Even though the 90s came and then he did The Hunted.
Well, yeah, wasn't he in the, he's in the Rush Hour sequel, isn't he?
Yeah, he's in Rush Hour 2, yeah.
Yeah, what sort of character does he play in that? Is it a similar character or not?
Yeah, really similar character. Yeah, he aged a bit. I mean, especially for aging, put some weight on. Yeah, but he plays exactly the same character.
Oh, right.
Not exactly the same character, but like a really similar character.
Well, they pretty much get typecast. Like I mentioned earlier about the guy who plays the hitman for John Lone. What's his name? Joey Chin, Abel Ferreira guy.
Yeah, Joey Chin.
He literally, he plays the same character, only a bit older and a bit kind of, like, more senior in King of New York.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, even the...
All you gotta do is just give him a members-only jacket and a cigarette and a gun, and...
Well, yeah,
that's all he does, man.
Exactly the same. I mean, even just shots like this, I mean, like, the big sort of, like, crowd scenes and stuff. I mean, obviously, they were shot in North Carolina, not New York. But just kind of, like, the scope of the sort of movie. And all the sets and stuff. Like, I mean, they must have spent a fucking shitload of money to kind of make all these sort of, like, no one less, like, Chinese laundry sort of thing.
Yeah, these scenes like this are just really well done. These underground,
noodle
factory, whatever the hell they are.
Well, it's like a Chinese laundry, isn't it? But it kind of, like, the guys get put in... I made a point of...
It
doesn't look like soya beans, right? But he actually mentions it earlier because he says that I found two of your guys in the soya bean shit, like, later on to John Malone.
Yeah, it looks like an underground laundry operation or something.
This character kind of stands out as a kind of, like, uh-oh, we need an really, like, honorable Asian character in the...
He's the one, yeah, exactly.
Because, like, I mean...
Don't piss off all the Asians.
Yeah, I mean, he's great in this scene. And then he pops up for the funeral, doesn't he? I was like, the first time I watched it, I was like, who the hell's this guy? And then once I watched it again, I kind of like, all right, that's the guy who's in the thing, because there's no real reason. I mean, he doesn't get to know Mickey Rourke so well in this scene that he had the right to go to his funeral, but he kind of does, you know what I mean, kind of in the sort of movie world, kind of like, oh, you know what I mean, kind of.
Yeah. I like the fact that he actually walks from there. It shows his, you know, pride and dedication to the case.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess a couple of, like...
call it a day, you know?
Yeah, when people watching, like, holy shit, man, you have to put some fucking boots on and stuff, you know what I mean? I mean, because that looks like a hell of an earth in there, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know they got the boots, they just, you know, he doesn't care, man.
It's stinking enough already without two dead bodies in there.
And I think after this scene, he goes to the reporter's house, man, doesn't even change his pants.
that's typical Mickey Rourke, because you read interviews about, like, the guy in general, and he's supposed to be, like, in reality, he's kind of, like, really kind of, like, I mean, he looks like a fucking, like, a gas station attendant, know what I mean, when he's, like, outside.
Yeah, that's what, exactly.
No,
he doesn't have a really good,
He's kind of, like, really kind of doesn't really pay
much. Yeah, he's a slob, man.
Yeah,
but
he's appearance and stuff, yeah.
He's like a James Dean slob.
Well, that's the thing, that one of the reasons, like, I mean, from reading all the articles and stuff on the guy, basically what seems to have happened with Mickey Rourke is basically he kind of came into the acting game with, like, the love of the art of acting, and he kind of went into Hollywood thinking it was kind of like, no matter how bad, no matter, like, what happened in the movie, as long as he was kind of taking on people with the acting, he could, you know what I mean, he could piss people off, but as long as he was kind of, like, he thought he was fighting people on his acting skills. Well, in reality, it's nothing to do with that. It's kind of all about business and it's money. And he kind of pissed a lot of people off. And what happened is kind of like he couldn't fight them on the sort of action sort of levels, and that's what kind of fucked him, you know what I mean? Basically, so like...
Exactly,
he bridges and stuff, people just kind of sick of working with him because he was like a really hard sort of difficult actor. But he wasn't necessarily a difficult actor. He just kind of came across like that.
Yeah. This restaurant scene right here, this one was actually not filmed in New York or North Carolina. This one was actually filmed in Vancouver, I believe.
I read a lot.
Just the restaurant.
How did you find that out specifically?
I got my ways.
All right, okay. Don't tell me.
I mentioned earlier, you know, from eBay, I got that press kit, so I know a lot of things that everyone forgot about, basically. I mean, there's no way I'd know that unless I own the press kit or anything
But I knew...
Or was actually on the set.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I knew there were scenes filmed in Vancouver, and, like, in certain movies that I've been filmed in Vancouver, I mean, I've been to Vancouver, you get the same feeling, think, oh, that's in Vancouver. I mean, Get Carter, the remake with Stallone, a lot of the scenes in that was shot in Vancouver. Helda was shot in Vancouver. I mean, the fact that you mentioned it was that internal restaurant scene, I'm thinking, how the hell did you know that?
it's just funny how they would actually do that. I don't get why they would film internally in a restaurant in Vancouver when you could just...
Well, it's just cheap.
I mean, you could go to L.A.
Cheap the money.
They were there on location anyway doing something else probably, so...
Well, not just cheap as hell. I mean, the fact that they're indoors doesn't make any difference.
Just cheap.
Well, yeah, because they probably had to build the restaurant set. For the, like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Like, a lot of people think, right, that'll be just a standard sort of restaurant they've found in Vancouver and they've gone in and filmed. But it's not often the case. Often the case is they've got, like, fuck all, and basically the set designer kind of says, what do you want for this? And the director says, I want something looking like this, looking like that. And they'll kind of knock it up and make the whole thing in one go. It's kind of like I mentioned the fact that this was quite a really high budgeted movie for the sort of the type of the like genre movie it is. And it's kind of interesting because after Heaven's Gate, no one in Hollywood had touched Michael Cimino. I can't say his fucking name. Mm-hmm. Michael Cimino with any with a barge pole because he completely sunk a fucking studio. So like no executive is going to risk his studio on this director. Whereas this was kind of made like outside of Hollywood as far as used Italian money. I mean, Dino De Laurentiis was this big hotshot Italian producer from like the 70s, making like stuff like he produced Barbarella and the King Kong remake in 76 and a couple of other things and a lot of other Belushi fucking films. What's his guy's name? The guy who did The Last Emperor. He did produce that, but he produced a lot of Italian.
Yeah,
films.
Yeah.
And he kind of kept sort of sneaking into Hollywood with like. No, I mean, he produced Conan the Barbarian. I think his daughter officially did it, but I mean, it was pretty much with his money.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of bankrolled a lot of Hollywood movies around this sort of time. And it's interesting, this was kind of this movie and a similar titled movie called Manhunter, which was originally called Red Dragon, of course, was basically the kind of death of his kind of, not studio, but kind of his the death of his kind of like, his big like onslaught on Hollywood. Because when this came out in 85 and completely bombed, that was when Manhunter was getting made under the title Red Dragon by Michael Mann, and basically Dino De Laurentiis said, oh, the fucking name Dragon's cursed, I don't want the name Red Dragon in the title. So that changed it to Manhunter, and then it still came out and flopped. So it was like, and then that was kind of like, whoa. And then De Laurentiis was kind of like, didn't run back to Italy with his tales from it, he kind of like vanished off the scene, wasn't as prominent. And it wasn't until Hannibal, the other Hannibal Lecter movie, that he kind of came back into Hollywood, in 2000 and kind of got a massive success with that, and then now he's, like, kind of shit off, big sort of bald producer again. I mean, his daughter's kind of produced a lot of things. I mean, he did Dragon the Bruce Lee story.
Yeah, Dragon the Bruce Lee story, that's right.
I mean, that was called Dragon and didn't flop, so that's kind of must have changed his mind.
Yeah. Yeah, this seems funny. I like all the photos in the background, shows him the family man side of him.
Yeah.
I mean, it shows him that he's still a family man. I mean, he's probably good when it comes to that, but when it comes to business, the guy's...
Well, not necessarily, because didn't he actually married the guy who kills in the opening scene, Stabs? That was his father-in-law, wasn't it? So that was his, like, wife.
Yeah, that was his father-in-law. Well, I guess I'm more towards the kid than,
But I mean, I think that's a lot of that's probably there for the fact of the matter. He's a wolf.
Exactly, yeah.
No, I mean, that's...
Killing his father-in-law. Yeah, get in his place.
Yeah, I mean, that's not there just for Mickey Rourke. I mean, he'll have that there for everyone else who kind of comes into the office and kind of think, all right,
I think that's kind of a cool theme that they mentioned there, You don't see a lot. I mean, in Hong Kong movies today, they do that, like, Young and Dangerous. I mean, that's just a cool theme about, wanting to rise up in the family, take out your own family to rise up.
It's
kind of a cool,
Well, that's this whole
thing. You can't get much sinister than that.
Well, yeah, this is kind of like, cannibalism eating your family from within.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's kind of like, that's what's really good about his performance, because he's kind of, on the exterior, he's this like really sort of cool, slick, really trustworthy businessman type thing. But, he's a complete ruthless bastard.
Exactly. He's a butterfly.
And the only person who knows it is Mickey Rourke.
Yep.
I mean, really, this is a really good scene, this, actually.
And he knows it for a fact, but he can't prove anything to his co-workers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no
one... He's doing that illegal wiretapping.
Mm. Exactly, no one believes him. It's actually interesting, I was watching Angel Heart the other week, kind of just doing my Mickey Rourke research, and the guy who plays John Lone's bodyguard, another black guy.
Yeah.
Well, he's actually got not a big role, but he kind of plays a character in Angel Heart. Just kind of like,
oh, does he really? Which character? I've seen that movie so many times.
Obviously just when they're in New Orleans, there's a guy who's kind of he's at a funeral procession at the beginning, which is a very like similar funeral procession. Actually, I forgot to mention that earlier, because I was watching this with a couple of friends, and the opening funeral procession in Chinatown? They're all expecting to be like a kind of a, like a James Bond live and let die.
That's what I always, every time I see that's what I think about,
Yeah, everyone's expecting like someone to like pop out and shoot someone, or like, the corpse to jump out and...
I'm really surprised they didn't put a shootout scene during one of the funeral scenes in this. Well, actually, they kind of do towards the end of the movie when, Mickey Rourke goes postal on those guys.
Yeah. Yeah, but the black guy there that he was in, I don't know who he is, but I just kind of recognize his face when I see him.
Chinese Connection. The opening of Fist of Fury reminds me a lot of the whole funeral sequence, because the music.
All right, yeah. Interesting.
I don't know why his wife being such a bitch right here. You know, at this point, I'm all for.
Well, yeah,
know.
she's kind of. She's not so much underwritten. She just doesn't have enough scenes in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see where you can see all the stones kind of trying to write a background story for her. I mean, like, obviously trying to have kids and Mickey Rourke's kind of not looking after his body and, like, obviously he's not being able to have kids and she's getting on a bit and blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, it's all there, but the first time kind of viewing you watch the movie, it's kind of like, it seems very, like, upfront and in your face. You kind of like, it's not like, I mean, whereas something like the Deer Hunter tech, like, I mean, 40 minutes at the beginning, kind of getting to know all this kind of irrelevant stuff, but obviously it's relevant when the story kicks in, whereas this kind of seems a bit rushed, and a character kind of suffers for that. I think it should be some more scenes with her, or it should be played out a bit slower. But, I mean, I really like the music in this movie is really good as well. David Mansfield.
Yeah,
well, kind of in high
school. Especially the Rod Stewart music.
Well, yeah, other than the Rod Stewart music. just the, obviously, he's got the opening credits title music, but, I mean, just the sort of the score of the actual thing. I mean, there's a bit there that I mentioned, but obviously got the sound mute, so I couldn't really remember it. But the bit where he says, like, you know what I mean, I'll be around long enough to piss on your grave, and they're kind of like this, like the music kind of kicks in after he'd said it sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. I think David Mansfield won an award. I think he won an award for best soundtrack, the best composed soundtrack for this movie.
I must admit, I didn't think this won any awards other than Irani won the Razzie Awards at the Raspberry Awards, where there was another the anti.
Oh, the Razzie Awards, yeah, the reporter won for that.
Yeah, she won like the anti sort of thing. I
mean, you've been doing your internet movie database checking, I see.
Yeah, well, it's just standard. I mean, you've probably done exactly the same research as I have. Only you've got.
I know. There's only so much you're the dragon.
You've got that press kit. I mean, it's like, you know, it's just like, let's.
I should be ahead of the game. I should be talking more than you right now.
I think you are, my daughter.
But actually, a lot of this stuff, the press kit, I mean, other than the stuff I mentioned already, doesn't really have a lot to it. It just goes behind the actors.
Yeah. I mean, there's trivia. I mean, if you want to mention the fact that this building was actually, like, completely constructed for the movie. I found this out. Basically, I was watching it on my friend's house, who's kind of like...
this building was?
Well, yeah, my friend's a big, like, interior designer-type guy, and he's got read loads of books on the subject, and I'm watching the movie with him, and all of a sudden, they're walking... This scene happens in the movie, and my mate's like, whoa, pause it, hold up. I'm like, well, you know, you want to piss? He's like, no, pause the movie. He kind of jumps up, and he starts going through all these fucking New York apartment books he's got on his... fucking in the middle of the movie? And he was like, no, just give me a minute. He goes, I've seen this apartment, I'm sure it's in this one of the... Anyway, he couldn't find it, so he was like, look, let's get the rest of the movie watched. So we watched the rest of the movie. And then, like, a couple of days later, he kind of found it. It was basically in the this book called The International Book of Lofts. It was actually, published in 86, so it was kind of, like, right after this movie was kind of made.
Yeah.
And this
was
actually, like, a complete block of flats, like, overlooking, like, the Manhattan Bridge and, like, all the rest of New York and stuff. I mean, I don't know specifically. But kind of, like, it was basically constructed by the designers for the movie. Like, basically, Michael Cimino said, look, I want an apartment for this reporter. So I obviously get a bed with the TVs on stuff for stuff and this and that and stuff. And it's kind of, like, it was pretty much constructed for the movie. And, I mean, it stayed there and they sold it on as a flat afterwards, but at the time it was kind of like... But, I mean, you look at this, before I knew that, and I'd assumed it would be, like, just a case of they've seen this, like, place and thought, oh, I like good, and we'll use this, you know what I mean? But, I mean, literally the design...
Well, now that you say it's constructed for, I mean, if you look in the background, see the curves on that window, it looks like it's just really messy, you know, I mean, it looks like it was built for that, you know? I mean, you see the windows, it's all rough towards the top of it, you know?
Yeah,
it's like,
but I know, but that's what I was thinking, I couldn't work out whether it was actually done for the movie, and then that was, like, okay then. But if the fact that it was in the International Book of Lofts, like, kind of led me believe that, actually, the made it.
Yeah,
it's been sold afterwards and kind of, like, I mean, it's literally an apartment for, you know what I mean, for whoever. I don't know how the hell she couldn't afford an apartment like that on her wage. You know what I mean? She must have gotten backhanders from the triads to afford a place like that. I mean, is it one hell?
No, I mean, these reporters make a lot of money, man. New York reporters like that.
Right.
She's got to be in Connie Chung territory, dude. She's
got a lot of fucking money to own an apartment like that. I mean, we'll see it later in the movie when it's daylight and you see it a lot better. But, I mean, what we haven't...
I mean, imagine if this place really does exist. Imagine the person living in it, and imagine if he or she was actually watching this movie saying, holy shit, that's my apartment.
Well, yeah, I think you'd know that on this. I mean, I don't think anyone would actually be able to buy this without them saying, oh, by the way, it was in The Other Dragon. But, again, they might, though. I don't know. They might put people off.
Yeah, that's true. They might. Yeah, but then,
they'll be like, what was that? So I'll Mickey
Rock. The Dragon isn't exactly a selling point. Yeah. I mean, you know.
And if they mention Mickey Rock, then they'll think, hang on, Mickey Rock.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, fuck this. I don't want this.
Exactly. You know what I mean?
Mickey Rock was in here? Oh, fuck this.
Exactly. He's been, like, eating.
But it's got some nice views. I mean, every time I see the Twin Towers, you know, the World Trade Center.
Yeah,
but.
Well, it's interesting that, because, I mean, it's kind of.
But I never noticed it, you know, prior to 9/11, but now.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say prior to watching it on widescreen video. Because, I mean.
No, actually, the pan and scan actually got him pretty good. Yeah. Scale of records there.
I mean, you see him later on, I mean, like, this scene at night, you can't really tell much, but yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that is one hell of a fucking view in an apartment, you know what I mean?
Okay, this is the part that won her the Razzie Award.
You think so? I think this is kind of. I mean, you wouldn't see this in the. I don't think you'd see this in a movie these days. It's too political correct, you know what I mean? It's kind of, this is like kind of a
yeah, it is, it is.
I mean, like, oh, is it kind of rape? Is it? No, it isn't, you know what I mean? It's kind of a bit too close to the sort of bone, whereas Oliver Stone kind of writes this sort of stuff in his sleep. I mean,
it's pretty sad looking at these girls' titties, man. I mean, it's pretty sad that mine are actually bigger than hers. But that's another story.
Right, okay.
Here's your favorite part right here, dude.
Yeah.
So this one he picks on the black guy. Out of all the guys, he picks on the black guy, dude.
Do you think so?
Yeah, he hits the black guy really hard, dude.
Yeah, well, it is quite good, this, isn't it? Like, never really kind of up for it. I mean, one of my friends was watching this, and he's kind of like, he kind of guessed the sort of punchline was coming, because he's kind of looking, he's thinking, why the hell? Like, he said, what? There's like a tiny little woman sort of sitting in there, know what I mean? One of these guys, like, little tiny woman sort of sitting, and he's like, what's she there for? And then obviously the punchline when he comes up, know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I really love this scene. I mean, the way it's filmed, everything. We haven't mentioned Alex Thompson, the guy who did the cinematography, and he's actually credited as a camera operator as well, which is quite rare. Like a lot of
What other films has the guy worked on?
He basically ones of note. I mean, he did Excalibur with John Boorman, which is which is a really like good looking movie, but it actually wasn't shot scope. It was kind of just like flat lens sort of thing. But he did like a lot of work on The Keep, which is a Michael Mann movie made like a couple of years before. And that's got like really, really good production values and really looks awesomely I mean, you need to see it in widescreen. And then he did Legend with Ridley Scott, which is another beautiful movie.
Tom Cruise.
And then he did Cliffhanger, which has got some like really good shots in it as well. But what's interesting is he does all his own camera operating, which basically like, what really impressed me when I first watched this was all the Steadicam work. Because I mean, like around like 85, it wasn't like a big deal to make like a Steadicam. I mean, obviously when it came out, the Steadicam kind of got invented like in the 70s. Like, it was used a lot in Rocky, but it wasn't kind of developed that much. And then when Kubrick had hired the bloke who invented the Steadicam, Garrett Brown, Kubrick had kind of hired him personally to operate his camera for The Shining. And The Shining's like kind of one big sort of, this is the Steadicam, this is what it can do type advert for it. But I mean, what's good about this is that you don't get a lot of Steadicam work with Panavision, like widescreen anamorphic lenses.
Yeah.
Because the cameras themselves are cool. Like, especially in 85, they're very, very big cameras. And obviously, with the lenses being so, like, kind of the compressed image, with the lenses being so, like, delicate, they're kind of, they're heavy as hell, and they're really sort of finicky about light. You need a lot of light to kind of light them. So you can't, like, do a lot of, like, I mean, you have to really, like, be a good cinematographer to light the scene and stuff. And he did a hell of a job on this, because, like, there's a lot of fucking scenes, like one here, for instance, indoors and stuff, and outdoors and everything. Everything looks beautiful.
Yeah. You can see everything, and there's commotion everywhere.
Yeah, but what's interesting, he actually gets a credit as, like, cinematographer and camera operator by. So, because basically, cinematographer's job is to kind of light the set, make sure everything looks what it does on film, that it should look according to what the director wants it like. And then you get, like, camera operators, who are just guys who kind of, they operate the camera for the cinematographer. But these guys kind of, like, one who wants to be behind himself. And then you get the other directors, like Luc Besson, who actually, they're like, are camera operators as well as directors. They're actually behind the camera themselves, kind of using it. Whereas most of them just sit on a big stool and kind of sit right on this, do that.
This is a really nice shot, you know, with the scene.
Yeah, this is probably probably a North Carolina job. I mean, everything was, but I mean,
every angle here, there's something going on, like, everywhere, you know, there's motion everywhere.
Yeah.
It looks like...
I really like the way it's done here with the camera within camera type thing. Like, I mean, all the camera's about, and then, like, this shot here where you get, like, the cameraman's, like, at the very right side of the frame.
Yeah, you can see his face, you can see Joey's face in there. Yeah, it's really well done. You know, like I said, a movie like this just doesn't get the appreciation until years and years later, which I think you'll finally get, you know, when a few people watch it.
It's one of these movies that, as much as it's been underappreciated and stuff, you can't really blame it because it's impossible to get hold of. I mean, I've... I've been wanting to see this, like, really bad for the last sort of 3-4 years. And, I've been checking every TV broadcast. Every channel, all the cinemas when they put the retrospectives on, all sorts. And I've seen loads of obscure movies in the cinemas and stuff like that. But this movie is just unheard of. When I found it on the fact that we're doing this commentary. It's more to the, obviously, because you're a big fan of the movie now, kind of really enjoy it, and we want to do another commentary. And obviously, it's got Dragon in the title, because we've done Enter the Dragon. So, we'll probably do Kiss the Dragon next door, or We're the Dragon. But anyway, one of the reasons, I'm going off a tangent now. One of the reasons, what was I talking about? Yeah, really hard to get hold of. Sorry,
gone back. Yeah, yeah.
And, I actually found this on Region 3 DVD.
Mm-hmm.
When I was looking for some Hayao Miyazaki movies or the Japanese animation, and I managed to find this by accident, kind of what the fuck, Year of the Dragon, Region 3.
Yeah.
And then bought
it. Out of nowhere, man.
And I've been on the internet, and it seems to me, you, and about two other people who actually bothered to buy it or actually been interested, you know what I mean? Because it really is off the radar of kind of most movie buffs, kind of, you know what I mean? As far as knowing what movies are.
Yeah, as far as, I showed this to a couple of friends, and a lot of people don't lie, I don't know why, but they don't like this movie. I think it's just a pride thing, but as far as Asian cinema fans, I've showed this to a few people, and they don't love it, man. They haven't, the only thing they mentioned bad about it is Aryan, man. That's the only thing they mentioned bad about it.
Yeah, I don't know. I watched this with my dad. Our dad really liked it, and I watched it with a couple of my friends, and
your dad liked it?
Yeah, they were really, really impressed with it, because they were just completely expecting completely different, and because...
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's like me saying to someone, "Have you seen Scarface?" and I'm saying no, and you're like, "Well, do you know what it is?" and they're like, "No," and it's like that's what it feels like to me, because this is just as much. This should have as much kudos in the kind of movie buff world as someone like Scarface does.
Yeah, Scarface. Yeah, it does.
No, Cimino's.
It should. Yeah,
just
it should.
As good a director as De Palma. It's a stone script.
Yeah, they're both up there.
Yeah, and the source novel it's based on, it's got depth to it, sort of thing. And it's just a really good movie, great performances and everything else, but it's just
even just reading the credits, it's just something you just don't think can go wrong with. You got Oliver Stone, it's a Laurentiis production, Michael Cimino directing it.
Yeah.
Mickey Rourke, John Lone.
Yeah. I think it's quite ironic.
The whole theme, the whole Chinese mafia thing is kind of cool too. Yeah.
Like I said, we should mention this scene before it goes off, but the guy who plays the mafia boss, well, that vice boss, I love films where they have really kind of obscure character things like this. I mean, really kind of off-center kind of characters. A mafia boss. It is feasible that a mafia boss. In The Godfather, the mafia movie. There's a bit where Marlon Brando gets shot, and he can't speak very well because he takes a bullet in the throat, and he's kind of he's obviously talking really badly anyway.
In
the movie, because he's kind of quite old. But just the kind of this guy here, kind of just kind of. You could imagine him, he says he's just had his throat.
Yeah. As silly as this throat thing, it's realistic, could actually see some guy walking around with one of those.
It doesn't seem really goofy, that's what I mean. It's really kind of, although it is kind of really off-center and kind of, you don't really...
Yeah, it would actually be more goofy if they just decided to put the guy in a wheelchair or something,
That's what I mean. There's a movie called, Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a
character. I've never seen that.
I haven't seen it myself, but there's a character in it called Christopher Walker, and he plays I don't know, I can't remember the details because I haven't seen the movie, but I was just hoping you might have done it, so I mentioned it. But yeah, it's another kind of off-center character, kind of. Anyway.
You gotta like this part where he has the guy, he's walking around carrying nothing while this guy carries everything.
Yeah, I know. This is another great scene, speaking about off-center characters, the nuns. Because the first time I watched this, what the fuck? When you soon see the nuns, you're like, what are you doing in here? And obviously, and the thing is, when I do that, I'll say it myself, obviously, but I've been watching this with friends, and they'll be vocal about it. So as soon as they walk in, they'll say, what the fuck are the nuns doing? And then you'll be like, just watch this for 5 minutes, and they'll be able to explain. Explain the subtitles, but I can't remember the exact names, but basically, they travel around, don't they, and look after people in them.
Uh-huh.
I can't think of the name, man. I'll tell you in a minute.
Nuns doing investigative work, man.
I can't think of the term for them. Basically, go around in missionaries. Sorry, missionaries. They're basically
missionaries.
That's why they're obviously they spent time in the Hangzhou province or whatever and speak the dialect.
As long as they tell these guys that they're doing good deeds, man, they'll do anything.
Yeah, but I just really love the scene where, like, Mickey Rourke comes in here and he's like, I mean, the other guy's munching, like, eating most disgustingly.
Eating like a pig, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, she's, like, gives him this massive thing, like, I've been eating for, like, 70 years the same stuff and blah, blah, blah. And he gives him all this fucking stuff.
I'll live a little long longer than you will.
Exactly, classic, man.
I can actually see Mickey Rourke acting like this in real life, too. Just cursing in front of the nuns and all.
Yeah, I love that movie, Riz. Excuse me.
Nice shot of the towers right there, the Brooklyn Bridge from the towers.
Yeah. But you see that, and I mean, the most interesting movie I've seen since the September 11th thing was their French Connection, because that was actually made, like, when they were building the...
are you serious? Did they actually show construction?
Yeah, you can see it, like, construction scenes in the background and stuff, but it's quite, like, interesting.
That's sweet, dude.
I mean, obviously, stuff like Escape from New York, where actually, like, the Twin Towers play, like, a big role in the movie, you know what I mean? They kind of have to go in there and kind of...
I never seen Escape from New York.
Oh, man, you got to get that watch, man.
Yeah. I remember trying to watch it, like, a few years ago, and I don't know what it was, and I just couldn't get into it.
You got to be in the movie.
I mean, it was the whole ninja star thing, you know? They're giving him his weapons, they're giving him, like, ninja stars. I mean, come on.
Yeah, but this is...
I know that's the whole point, but... Yeah. I don't know. Another well choreographed scene with everyone going crazier.
Yeah, just everyone in there slamming down.
There's the guy just sits his pants. That's one thing I didn't notice in the widescreen version.
What?
See, there are some good things about pan and scans, man.
Wait, I missed that. What did you see?
The guy that, you know, the thing guy, the guy that never speaks, he just got out of the bathroom, like, he zipped up his pants, man.
Alright, yeah.
He just took a leak or something.
The Sphinx or whatever his name is.
Yeah, the Sphinx.
What do you call him? He calls him something like that at the beginning of the movie.
I call him the thing, dude, from Fantastic Four.
Oh, all right, yeah.
Don't put beer cans in the office. This has to be after hours, man.
Well, yeah, well, let's just product placement, isn't it? Like a couple of Heinekens and Budweisers.
Yeah.
Anything else there? Surprised they didn't go to McDonald's when they're eating their burgers, actually.
Yeah, this scene right here really shows the cops' obsession, man, to take the triads down.
Yeah.
Everyone else is just ready to clock out for the day, and this guy's still going on about it, you know?
That's what I mean. I really like the fact...
These guys want to go home to their families, and this guy's like, that's his family.
I mean, it's a cliche now, but, I mean, it's kind of true in some respect. I mean, a lot of people, like, in any sorts of, like, walks of life, the most obsessed people kind of thing, you know what I mean? They kind of get the jobs done sort of thing, and obviously they kind of not so much neglect the families, but they kind of just... The most important thing to them is the work. And this is one of the characters
just the way these other guys are acting towards him, I mean, it just makes sense that these guys are so annoyed by him, you know? He's making himself look stupid because he's so obsessed about something that really shouldn't matter to him, you know?
I really like this scene because it kind of gives you a bit more background between these two characters, because you kind of believe that they actually were friends, like, in Vietnam or whatever.
Yeah.
And it kind of adds a lot to it. I mean, the fucked up bit with the framing with the punch. I mean, there's air between the swing if you freeze frame it.
Oh, really? I never froze frame it.
Yeah, it wasn't a freeze frame job. I mean, I noticed it just from catching it straight off. I mean, it doesn't detract from the movie at all, but I mean, it's kind of, if you want to be looking for stuff like that, then fair enough, it's there. You just kind of think, if you only move the camera just behind his head a bit more.
He's pushing him out.
Yeah.
Don't you own a bed sweater like that guy right there, dude?
Not really.
Oh, okay, I thought you had one.
Yeah. Got a t-shirt, that's about it. There we go, here's the punch.
Yeah, here it comes. You do it sideways?
Ah, classic.
I think that's what pissed him off. It wasn't about his wife. It was sideways. There it is. Now that you pointed that out, I noticed there's like 12 inches of air between.
Yeah, well, you know it's coming because the guy kind of steps back, and if he hadn't stepped back, they wouldn't have been able to put a swing in.
Oh, he's just, I gotta see that again, man.
Oh, man. You actually done the same as you did on Enter the Dragon, Ian, and you're about 5 seconds ahead of me on the screen time.
Oh, about 5 seconds ahead of you?
Mm.
All right.
Don't worry about it, though.
Yeah.
what do you think that emblem is on his tie? He kind of twizzles it in the beginning scene when it references Vietnam.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I'm not really sure. Obviously, it's some kind of...
It makes the connection with the U.S. Air Force, and says, like, you're not a member of the airborne infantry anymore, sort of thing. When he says it, I assume it's kind of that. I mean, you know what you assume.
Yeah, it's something to that matter.
Unless you're kind of...
Look at that old computer in the background there, dude.
It's not a bad because it doesn't get used in the movie. I mean, you watch a lot of movies from this period that deal with computers, and they're kind of completely archaic because they're so, like, running out of date. I mean, the thing is with this movie, although it was made in 1985, there's not that much in it that actually says, we're here, we're in the 80s, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
The music itself is kind of, it's timeless, so to speak. And, I mean, all the...
Yeah, it is. A lot of it is, yeah.
The clothes and everything.
That's kind of a good thing, you know? It just makes the whole movie timeless.
It is a good thing, though. I mean, I'm not one to kind of...
This right here. This is a good thing right here.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, I was watching this thing. My mate was on about the showers. You know what I mean? Because obviously he's a designer, interior designer guy, and he was, like, saying about the... He's, like, saying, I wouldn't mind a sort of shower like that anyway, but his girlfriend wouldn't have it. You got any friends?
That pad, I mean, even for 85, that pad looks, you know, looks like something you'd see in today's, you know.
Well, that's what I mean. It was made, like, the fact that it made the International Lofts of the book in 1986 kind of says that it was something special. I mean, Jesus, there must be a million and one lofts in the world. And there was only about 50-odd in the book.
Hmm.
And it was obviously designed for the movie sort of thing, so it was kind of a cutting edge of the design of that sort of period.
I wonder if Faye Wong was copying this chick's look for Chunky Express.
Yeah, she. I've read a couple of sites that mentioned the fact that she looks very similar to Faye Wong.
But I think a lot of Asian actors, especially in the Hong Kong movies, like Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, and the directors Stanley Tong, the guy who did Rumble in the Bronx.
Please, sorry.
A lot of them actually, you know, they're like really proud this movie was made. I've read a lot of interviews with these guys, and they always use this movie as a reference when they're talking about, you know, Chinese people in Hollywood movies.
Well, that's what
they always bring up *You're the Dragon*.
Well, the thing is, right, the only reason this kind of...
John Lone. They always bring up John Lone and *You're the Dragon* because it was big.
The thing I was saying earlier, the reason they had the disclaimer on the video release, and whether it was on the cinema, I don't know, but basically the disclaimer about this is not there to represent all Asian Americans, blah, 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 and this and that. I think the fact that was there is just, this was so, like, unique a movie. I mean, I'll have a think once I've mentioned this point of other movies that represent Asians in Hollywood movies, like, previous to 1985. But, I mean, at the time, this was kind of a really unique movie. And because the Asians in it had a prominent role, and the majority of them were triads, they kind of felt a bit like, oh, sorry, we don't want to kind of stereotype your whole culture. But there wouldn't have been a problem at the time if it had been Italians. No one in his right mind gets pissed off when Italians get played back in the Mafia. No one watches Goodfellas and goes, you're just stereotyping Italians, you know what I mean, and the Godfather. Because there's so many films that's been done to death. It's just kind
of,
the Italians are probably proud of the fact, they're like, alright, every time they're on screen, we're in the Mafia, blah, blah. Whereas the Asians at the time, I can understand, I think it probably wasn't so much Asians that have been offended by it, but just political correct, like white people. We're just scared that Asians would react to it in that way. And I'm kind of like...
Yeah.
Because there's nothing... I mean, you watch it now and it's kind of like... It's completely like... I mean,
The thing is, it's not even a cliché thing. I mean, usually, you know, when you think of bad Asians or bad Asian gangs in the movies like this, I mean, it's not usually a serious thing. They make these guys... You know, they give these guys nunchucks.
Yeah.
They make them like Asian ninja killers or something like that. You know, it's never like really serious, you know? They don't portray them as real crime lords or anything, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't see people complaining about, you know, Big Trouble in Little China. I mean, that was it was kung fu, you know? It's just an uncliched thing, and it bothered people, you know, that this wasn't, you know, it wasn't a chop sake flick. It was actually, you know, Asians doing real shit using guns and stuff.
But yeah, but you know, like you now mentioned Big Trouble in China again. I mean, both of them, like, both Big Trouble in China and Year of the Dragon both, like, flopped. And they were both, like, made, like, I mean, 85 and 86, and they're both, like,
way... Yeah, they were at the same time, yeah.
Yeah, and Big Trouble in China is another film which got really, really good production values and stuff. I mean, as far as it being, like, the budget wasn't as high as this, I don't think. But it's still got, like, really, like, stands up
to date. It still looks like a really good, like, some of those sets.
Yeah, like, that was another one where they built, like,
I mean, I'm wondering if they actually use some of the, you know, it'd be interesting. They're made so, you know, really close together. I wonder if they even use some of the sets, some of the same sets.
I don't think a lot of the big Triple China sets are all bloody fantastical, kind of like, you know what I mean,
yeah,
ancient Chinese type.
Yeah, that's true. Kind of, well, I was more talking about some of the alleyways and some of that stuff, because there's a funeral scene in Big Trouble in China also. I mean, probably not. I'm sure we would have known about it by now. But
well, no, not really. I don't think kind of there's plus one's MGM movie. The other's a...
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that. But studios always swap, you know. Even Golden Harvest used some of the Shaw Brothers studios for some of their stuff.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, I suppose.
But, you know, yeah, but that's a different country, so who knows.
Yeah.
Here's she's putting her model runway stuff to work
exactly
here.
With
the way she's walking, she's like in full model, you know.
Well, yeah, this is just a big, like, I mean, this freaking awesomely shot thingy, you know, I mean, light and internal and out external sources. I mean, you get that.
Have you seen, I think it's Red Corner with Richard Gere?
No, I haven't. I think it's a Rise.
It's actually a pretty good movie. Check it out. There's a similar scene like this, because he sleeps with a Chinese chick, and then she wakes up in the night, and there's a scene just like that.
All right. Yeah, I was reading that.
Now that this one Hong Kong actor you're talking about, White Powder Moss, coming up, then I want you to tell me about him.
Yeah, I've
seen him in Hong Kong.
I
don't know much about him. I don't even know his name.
Well, this is a new like location, obviously, like kind of a big kind of.
Yeah, does he have a pink shirt like that, dude?
I don't have a pink shirt like that, yeah.
Oh, okay, all right. I thought you did.
No.
Here you go.
I think I borrowed one of you once, but I didn't. No, basically, this...
Here he is, man. Here he is.
Right, this guy, he's called Fan Mu Sang.
Okay.
And he basically, he's a big kind of actor in Hong Kong. He kind of plays, like, a lot of, like, he's a character actor. He doesn't play, like, any star roles. But every time, I've been watching loads of the Shaw Brothers movies lately, and he always kind of pops up. You'll sort of see his face. You'll be like, oh, that's that guy there. He's also in a couple of Jackie Chan movies. But he's actually more famous now for the fact that his son is Ricky. Story of Ricky? The guy who plays.
Oh, the main guy?
Yeah, the main guy in Story of Ricky. Fan Su Wong. This is Fan Mu Sang, and his son's called Fan Su Wong. And that's the guy who plays the guy in Story of Ricky. So it's kind of like, this is his dad. But I mean, this is like 85. I mean, this is pretty much, I mean, if you watch Project A Part 2, this guy's in it, and he looks exactly the same haircut. Same
Yeah, Project A 2, that's right, that's where I've seen him in, yeah.
Yeah. But it's another kind of, like, I mean, there's...
He's got one of those recognizable faces, man. He's always got the same, you know, the goatee and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the long hair and the goatee, definitely.
He's a lot more heavier in this movie. You know if he's passed away or not?
No, he's still alive and kicking. As far as I know, yeah, I mean... Yeah, I think so.
When I was a kid, I actually thought this guy was the guy in Way of the Dragon, you know, Akun.
Oh, right, yeah, the Akun.
When I was a kid, I thought it was him, because it looks a lot like him, you know, just a little chubbier and, you know.
Yeah. It's actually interesting story about the Akuns, because I remember when I was first on the forum, and I kind of listened, there was always you and Raven and a couple other Bruce Lee fanatics, always talking about Big Boss and...
Bang Lines from Edge.
And you're always on about the Akun guy, and you're always saying, like, you didn't realize that the Akun guy in Way of the Dragon was different to the Akun guy in Big Boss and...
In Big Boss, yeah.
You know, kind of different kind of roles. Now, I'm thinking, what the fuck are these guys talking about? You know what I mean? I kind of walked in thinking, I was like this big Bruce Lee fanatic, and I was like, I don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
They kind of went and you've got...
There was another crucifix in that scene.
Sorry?
There was another crucifix scene.
Oh, right, yeah. The big church, yeah. I mean, you see that church in the opening shots, establishing the house. It's kind of got the, down the end of the street. But it's a really good... I really like the way it's filmed, this, because the fact that you kind of get the John Lone character in Bangkok, and then you kind of set that up, and then it cuts back to this bit here, and then when all hell breaks loose, what's going to happen here, before it kind of gets resolved, it kind of cuts back, and you kind of get another Bangkok thing, and it's really good the way they kind of, like, show the two characters kind of both kind of show the way shit's happening, because John Lone's obviously kind of went off to Bangkok, give the order to kind of get Mickey Rourke and his wife shot, or just maybe Mickey Rourke and his wife gets killed in the aftermath, I'm not sure.
Perfect. He's out of town and, you know.
But yeah, I really like these scenes, actually. I like a lot of the scenes between his wife and him and his wife in the movie.
Yeah, it's some pretty good dialogue exchange, interaction and stuff.
Yeah, so he's kind of got his taxi driver.
I never noticed that. I wonder why he decides to throw that on after, you know, after wearing the suit, you know, Armani suits.
Well, I think he must have thought.
Well,
it's just probably more to do with the fact that he's got to do a lot of action. Well, not a lot of action, but you know what I mean? He's kind of like, well, let's just kind of... wears like khaki uniform for the shootout
suit. Yeah.
And actually, if you look at the right of the screen here, you see the glass on the side when Caroline Carver's talking. If you look in the glass, you can kind of see a reflection of like the camera crew.
Oh yeah, I see right there, right.
I mean, you can't. It's really a bit non-specific as what it is, but you can tell it's not meant to be there.
At least I got that washer fixed. Looks like it's not in the middle of the kitchen.
Yeah, I know. A friend made a remark about the fucking fruit. I said, "What sort of fucking fruit's that?" And I mean, who the hell has that much fruit? But to be honest with you, I checked it out in detail. And it's a false, like, I mean, it's just like a standard fake fruit bowl thing.
Yeah,
it was real, like, I mean. Like, if you're going to, I just fancy a pear, peach, apple, banana. I mean, yep. Every fruit under the sun's in there.
You see the hat in the background?
Yeah. It's not
bad. Don't you own one of those?
I can see this going to be a running theme. I was going to say earlier, bastard. Classic. No, but this is, a lot of, the, when I was watching this with my friends, they kind of knew that this was going to happen. I don't know why. They just kind of.
Oh, they knew about his wife? Oh, she was going to get slaughtered?
Yeah, I don't mean they actually knew. I just mean they got a sense from watching the movie. Whereas I'm pretty slow on these sort of things. I tend to be like three steps behind the plot most of the time with a lot of these movies. I don't know why it's the case, but I kind of sometimes get so involved with a specific scene, I kind of don't look at it at the big outlook. I mean, my mate was watching it, and he was kind of very aware of all John Lone was kind of. I mean, he knew that he'd kind of got the triad. He knew he was hiring the kind of. He was killing the family from within and stuff. And I was kind of like, I mean, I didn't realise it until like many, many scenes later. And this scene here, like, I mean, I don't know whether it gets flagged or not in the. It must do, because my mate kind of picked up on it and knew nothing about it. It's kind of like. I really like this scene as well with the music playing and stuff. And he's kind of sitting drinking the.
Yeah, this is kind of reminiscent of the whole Deer Hunter theme.
Yeah.
They tried to emulate in a way.
I mean, what might have happened there? I mean, a lot happens in movies anyway. When they're making a movie and if the score isn't written previously, or the music guy is kind of not going to work until after the movie's finished, what will happen is the director like lay down temp tracks while he's making the movie, just to kind of give the guy who's making the music a kind of an idea of what sort of music he kind of likes in that scene. So what they might have done is he might have thought, right, I'll use the Deer Hunter theme there. So he puts the Deer Hunter theme over that scene. Then when David Mansfield gets it to score, he kind of knows the director wants something like a Deer Hunter theme, but the fact that he's put the Deer Hunter theme there kind of implants that in his head. So when he's writing his own score, it kind of comes off like the Deer Hunter theme, you know what I'm saying?
Happens
a lot, sort of thing. But I mean, even other than the Deer Hunter theme, it's got a lot of other good music in it, sort of thing. So I think it cheapens it to say that. I mean, this is a brutal scene to watch. I mean, wow, I was kind of like, holy shit, you know what I mean? Like, when the fucking guy gets in, and you look and you're like, fucking hell, and.
Oh. I mean, especially the fact that she got her smoke. I mean, her.
Yeah, smoke. The aftermath.
If she got shot, that'd be a different story.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot quicker. I mean,
this next scene, I think this is like totally. I kind of like just look away every time I see this scene. Right,
what with the Mr. Hand Dummy?
No, that too. But actually, when this car bumps into the wall, it crashes into the wall.
Well, you know what? I was thinking that myself.
Fast forward, and it blows up.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole blown up thing. I mean, that's just like, come on. I mean, it's kind of like. That looks like something even Michael Cimino would have wanted.
Yeah, but you know what?
Listen, man, we need some explosions, man. All right, I'll make this.
I understand where you're there, Jeff. But the only thing I agree. This scene there when he pulls the fucking body out on fire, that is an awesome scene. And at the end of the day, that scene wouldn't have happened if the car hadn't exploded. So whether they've rewritten it a bit differently to kind of make the car set fire a bit more like realistically, or just that, I can forgive the fact the car blows up when it hits the wall, just for the fact that you get the fucking shot of Mickey Rourke on fire.
Yeah, I know. I thought about that before.
No, I mean, it's kind of like, okay then.
Yeah.
But the thing is, these days, if a movie like this was happening, them scenes would be a lot longer. They'd be a lot more drawn out. That's what I quite like about the Hunter's the same. This is the same. And the Sicilian, the Sicilian's not a really good movie. And one of the problems with it is the problems with it is because it's played by Christopher Lambert, and his character in it is kind of very sort of straight-laced and like very humorless. I mean, same with Mickey Rourke, but Mickey Rourke's got so much more charisma than bloody Christopher Lambert. But the scenes, there's some violent scenes in the Sicilian one I really like Year of the Dragon, like, you know what I mean, the really like brutal violence, just like, there's a guy where he has to get killed, and Christopher Lambert's character kind of gets a shotgun and kind of shoots him down in the middle of the street in front of everyone, and it's just like really violent sort of boom and he's dead.
Was it a good scene?
Yeah, really good scene, sort of like, shit man, I mean, but the rest of the movie kind of doesn't like hold up to that, whereas these days you don't really get sort of scenes like that where they're just kind of really brutally violent, they're all like drawn out, slow-mo, normally John Woo-esque type. You know what I mean? The action scene will be like 15 minutes long, and the plot before will be like 2 seconds. You know what I mean? It's kind of the other way around. Where this is like more about the characters and the happen to get in these situations rather than like the action. I mean, this isn't an action movie in the slightest. I mean, you kept saying to me, it's not an action movie, it's not an action movie, because I think you were frightened I was going to kind of watch it like a John Woo movie or something.
Yeah.
Expecting me, like, expect to shoot him up. You know what I mean? But
are you saying this is an action movie or not an action movie?
It is an action movie. It's a crime drama. It's like something like a French Connection. You know what I mean? It's not an action movie. There's action in it. But it's not by default there just for the sake of the action. It's there for the sake of the characters, and it's got the action. I tell you what, like, they've spent tons and tons of money, like, obviously, to get all the extras here. But obviously, the fucking last minute, they thought that the guy who got the horses is completely fucked up. And as I've seen the state of the horses, they're all about fucking pony size. And it's as if they've turned up on the set and they've said, where the fuck are the horses? He's like, there they are. He's like, they're fucking ponies. Look at the size of the horse. I mean, he's almost walking.
Yeah, that's it. I never realized. Yeah, that's right. Look at that.
He's always walking.
Look at what John Luna's on. John Luna's a small person as is, so that's gotta be a size of a poodle, dude.
I mean, I was like, what the fuck's going on here? And I mean, they've spent all the budget on the army, and they've like, where the horses?
They could have got rid of like 1,000 extras and just got real ponies, man.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, he's just like walking, and the horse is walking under him. Yeah. It's classic, man. But, I mean,
I didn't even notice that, dude.
No, man. It's just, I was watching it. I was thinking, hang on, what's going on here? But this is like another. You wouldn't see this. There's no way they'd have this in some like the similar sort of movie. Like, I mean, like the Corruptor or something like that. There's no scenes in the Corruptor that would have like this sort of scope to them and stuff.
Yeah, where they're meeting, they're really.
Exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, this is just the standard. Like, I mean,
Rapid Fire. The beginning of Rapid Fire has a scene similar to this where they go.
All right. Right. Yeah. No. Setting. Think about. I mean, it doesn't have that many extras in the background.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's always, like, two kids and a guy.
Yeah, I know, the one in Rapid Fire, you know
what I mean? Ball or something, yeah.
The one in Rapid Fire could well have been shot, like, I don't know, somewhere in America, you know what I mean? Whereas this is, like, you can tell it's definitely Bangkok, you know what I mean? You know who this guy is?
This guy right here, I don't know, jeez, what's his, the guy that plays Bamsung.
Yeah, he looks familiar.
I know that guy's actually Japanese, he's not Thai.
Yeah,
I think his real name is Yukio Yamamoto or something.
Yeah,
like that.
He looks like the, do you know the big Japanese guy at the moment in Hollywood, the guy who was in Die Another Day in Fast and the Furious, and he was in Snowfall.
Oh, the guy, James Bond movie, right, the guy who was in James Bond?
Yeah, Ricky Young or something it's called. Ricky.
Yeah, he's the Korean guy.
Yeah, he's Korean, oh, sorry, I thought he was Japanese.
I don't see the resemblance. I mean, but then again, I haven't seen Ricky Young in too many movies. I saw him in Die Another Day,
The first time I seen this, I was like, you're kind of shocked at the state of this guy, aren't you? I was like, is that a dummy? At first I thought it was like a kind of a prosthetic.
Yeah, the guy looks like, yeah, he looks like hell, dude.
And when he sort of moves, you're like, shit, man, it's a real person. Seriously, it looks like you're watching a Cronenberg movie and his head's about to explode.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It looks like something in a wax.
I know, it's like, man.
This scene was cool, man. I mean, this must have been like really eye-opener when people saw it in theaters back in 85.
Yeah.
Next head scene with the white power mom guy.
Definitely.
At the dinner table, man. Really pass the guns down. I mean, this one's like really Deer Hunter, you know.
Basically, they make a big deal of it where he kind of says, like, and he passes the gun down. I mean, I'll have to read the subtitles here to kind of get exactly the thread I'm going to talk about. But it's kind of, he makes a big deal and says, like, passes the gun down, and then the gun goes down the table and you kind of see the gun. And then when he kind of says, like, his kind of point is, like, money's more powerful than the gun, he kind of passes the money down. But they don't make a bigger deal as passing the money down. It's like, I wish there was a shot of the money going down the same way the gun comes down. And he pulls the gun out at the end. The money out at the end, sorry.
That's John Lone's partner, the black guy. I don't find it too realistic, like him sitting there eating, because, you know, usually when you get like an American too.
I think
when people touch the food, it's like, you know, Jim Kelly and End of the Dragon.
Well, yeah, this guy's like he's a disposable black guy, but he's not that disposable.
Yeah, that's true. He does speak Chinese, so he's got to
No, but I mean, he's not in it. Like, I mean, I call him a disposable black guy, but he isn't really, because I mean, although he gets killed at the end, I mean, it's at the end of the movie. He might be there just to kind of get a token black guy in the movie, so to speak.
I was always wondering why they picked a black guy. No black guys in the movie except, you know, that one cop.
And, exactly.
Yeah, you're probably right, you know, just to give it that, you know, that really uncliched edge, you just got to throw a black guy in there.
Well, it's not uncliched, it is cliche. It's kind of like, It's like kind of cover all.
Yeah,
bases.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, I mean, in like a Chinese mafia movie, yeah, you don't see black guys.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, like, to be fair, I mean, if it was a mafia movie, you wouldn't see a black guy because there's like kind of like the Italians don't get on with the bloody the black guys, and obviously with the Asians, you could be forgiven for thinking, oh, well, they might, like, you know what I mean? They might have a black bodyguard in it. I don't know. Because you don't need
I guess you are. I think that guy does kind of, now that I think about it, he looks like Rick guy you're talking about. Fast and the Furious guy.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's not
English. The first time I saw this movie, I was just waiting for them to kill that guy. I was, like, just waiting for it.
Yeah.
Know? Michael Cimino always wants to shock me, you know, after watching those Russian roulette scenes in Zero.
Yeah, I know.
You're ready for anything, man, you know?
Having said that, I mean, Cimino's, his violence is very kind of, it's sharp, quick, and, like, shocking. I mean, he doesn't draw out on it or sort of, it's not exploitive, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not really, but when
when he picks up fucking white powder's head.
He doesn't exploit it, but it's quick, you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's
brutal and quick, but he doesn't sit there and exploit. He doesn't, you know...
Well, it's more realistic, because, I mean, if something shit happened, like, you know what I mean, if someone picked a bloody head up and put on a table, you wouldn't sit there gawping at it. You'd be like, whoa, you'd be shocked.
He keeps it real, but he doesn't leave it in your face.
Yeah,
you know?
Like the opening restaurant scene what I was saying earlier about it being, like, really kind of realistic. I mean, the kind of shit happens in there. You don't know what the hell's going on. People are getting shot left, right, and centre. And if you actually go through its freeze frame, you can kind of, it's very well choreographed. I mean, when I was making that flash thing for it, I was having to go through and grab the pictures and stuff, and it's really well done the way it's choreographed and put together sort of thing, but it's kind of done it in a such a way you don't really notice that. It's just kind of like, whoa, everything's happening. It looks like it's been just stuck together, but it hasn't. It's kind of a lot of thought gone behind each shot and stuff.
I like how it's stuck to the plate. Another thing that interests me about John Lone is he was also a member of the same, not the same, but he was also a pecking opera.
Yeah, I read that as well. I wasn't sure if I'd like hallucinated or something, because I mean I've done my research and stuff. Yeah. It was a while back, so I've been trying to do this for months.
It's actually a very common thing for a lot of Chinese actors, you know, especially. Yeah. I mean, that was just their acting school, man. That's where it all started, if you want to be in the entertainment business.
Well, yeah, that's exactly. You know what I mean? I mean, it's called the Peking Opera School, but it was obviously made for opera stuff, but because when the big boom in Hong Kong came about making movies, that was kind of like took over, because the opera was like, you know what I mean, there's no money in it, you know what I mean? But this is what I was meaning about the way the scenes are sort of juxtapositioned between, like, the scene of him, like, getting his wife killed and the other guy kind of killing the drug baron.
What's your take on this scene? What's your take on the reporter, you know, barging in there, looking really sad about this whole thing?
Well, the first time
I'm not sure if she's sad about him crying over his wife, or if she's sad about the whole thing, or what. I'm not really quite sure what it is.
I don't know. The first time I watched this, I kind of felt it was a bit out of place having all the thing there, but now I'm watching now, it's obviously, this guy's like the chief bloody police officer in Chinatown, and if his wife's being killed, and obviously the media are going to cover it, so, like, the media are going to be there sort of thing.
So why is she looking all the? I mean, why does she look like she's just seen a ghost? You know, she's like looking at him. See right here, she's looking at him.
Well, I don't know, because it's kind of like. No, I mean, I don't know. Rock's kind of probably thinking.
She knew she was. I mean, did she know he was married?
I don't know.
I think that's my thing. I don't think she knew. She knew the guy was married, and you know, and now she's just finding out. It's like, oh my god.
No, I think.
I didn't know you were married and your wife is dead. What the hell's going on here?
That might work if she wasn't a reporter, because obviously she's a reporter. She's reporting on.
Yeah. Reporters find out, you know, before they even hang out with a guy, they'll find out.
Well, exactly. She'll know his fucking wife and all his previous girlfriends. I mean, exactly. Yeah. Know everything.
Chicks don't give a shit if you're married these days, man.
Well, yeah.
They're just as bad as guys, man.
But I think the fact he's upset is just because, like, I mean, she probably wants to be there to comfort him, but she's there as a reporter to kind of cover it. And it's kind of like, well, what the fuck? I mean, she doesn't know where to look.
Yeah, it's kind of a mixed emotions thing too. Yeah. You know, it's kind of a real awkward thing because, you know, she just
he's the talking.
Well, they both just cheated on her, you know.
He's the talking good Asian guy. The cliche.
Yeah, he pops up. They let him in. They let him in.
That's what I mean.
They let him go in. That Asian guy. The Asian guy even killed his wife.
It could be a triad member with a fucking Glock on his. You know what I mean? Pull a Glock out.
Yeah, yeah. For all they know, this guy's behind the whole thing, you know?
Exactly. Well, that's what I thought. What if I seen it? I
was like, this thing was, like, thrown in here to say, you know...
Well, I said
like
that earlier, yeah, but when I
first... You need one Asian guy that's like, you know, we gotta make him look good.
Exactly. But when I first watched it, I didn't know who he was. I was like, who is this guy? And then I was like, oh, right, it's the guy from the beginning where he kind of helped.
Yeah, I didn't even know that until, like, the 18th time I watched it, that this was the same guy.
Well, that's what I said. That took me two calls to watch it.
It took you about two times to watch it.
Yeah.
The first time you watched it, like, who the hell is this guy, man?
Exactly.
Yeah, because, you know, when you first saw him, he's all dirty and scummy, wearing glasses, doesn't look like the same guy.
Yeah, but I really like these scenes in this sort of movie. I mean, there's kind of like the mourning for his, like, dead wife. I mean, because he kind of does it on Ian, and then he kind of goes back and...
Michael Cimino likes to spend a lot of time in like in churches and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know.
He likes to spend a lot of, like, when it comes to events like this, where there's weddings, funerals, or whatever, he likes to spend a lot of time just dealing with it.
Yeah. But you don't actually see a lead actor cry in a kind of, I don't know, when they're playing like tough guys. I mean, you wouldn't get Clint Eastwood doing that, I don't think. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Kind of, he just.
It's kind of the star right here where it was going down the whole. This kind of reminds me of the Michael Jackson "Beat It" video.
Oh, is that because the guy?
I mean, if you watch the "Beat It" video a lot of times, it just looks really like frame by frame the same as that. But
right.
You know, watches Michael Jackson nowadays besides me.
Right, before you ask, I haven't got one of them lumberjack shirts.
Oh, okay.
I did have one in 1985. In 1985, I did have one. But that was 1985.
In 1985, you said?
85.
Oh, okay, 85. Well, there was a time when the flannels and those lumberjack shit, they were, like, in style. But now
actually, I just interrupted you.
The white trash thing.
I really love the way Mickey Rourke acts this scene, because if you look at him here, when he looks at him, he's going to punch him before he kisses him.
Yeah, exactly,
It really is well done. Like, I mean, personally, I'm kind of, my all eyes on Mickey Rourke every time he's on the screen, so he's kind of like, you notice it, obviously, but I mean, I wasn't sure if you've noticed it, but just the way he kind of, like...
If you think about it, this is like the first time Stanley White is actually not even thinking about the case right now. He's just thinking about, he's just misery right now because of his wife.
Mm.
I mean, look on his face, he's not even thinking about the mafia right now. He doesn't even care about it. He's just, he's not even going to get hit. He's like, oh, shit.
Yeah, that's just really well done, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Pac-Man, Defender, and Galaxian.
Yeah, I couldn't spot Galaxian, but yeah, cool.
You gave me a yellow right there. This is a real hard scene.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say this is my favorite scene in the movie. Well, it pretty much is, I suppose. I mean, obviously, almost was a hard scene, but just kind of a really good... It's just a really good scene. I really like emotional scenes in movies, you know what I mean? Kind of where you're trying to get...
Yeah, especially when you feel the emotion, that's when you
need... Yeah, I mean, I said there's this one, and the one when he's drinking the Budweiser prior to his wife getting shot, or strangled.
Yeah.
Just kind of that scene. It was actually really weird, actually, because I had some Budweisers in the flat. Like, I don't know, I mean, I've, like, drink in the flat, because I don't really drink in the flat. Well, I actually had some from, like a while back, and I was kind of watching this scene the other week, and I kind of like watching it. He's drinking the Budweiser, and I literally went, I've got a Budweiser.
Yeah.
Pause it, got a Budweiser, just kind of like getting the character. It wasn't
right.
I never do. I was like, oh man, I've been just product placement. You know what I mean? I've kind of been sucking in.
In that scene while you're going off, I noticed a Chinese mafia book in the bookcase.
Oh, yeah.
While he was mourning his wife. Now that we're doing this commentary, I'm like, it seems like I'm really looking around for things. That's why I didn't notice this, you know, earlier.
Yeah. I've ironically got it on a TV and a laptop screen at the same time, but because it's only 14-inch TV and 15-inch laptop, and I'm sat right in the back of the bed, I can't really see very well. So I'm kind of struggling to kind of...
I can't stand watching it, no matter how good the quality is or sound or whatever. I can't stand watching stuff on a computer.
Well, yeah, I mean...
I don't know what it is. I mean, I just can't stand it.
Well, I mean, I don't do it myself. I mean, I run it into the thing, but I mean, obviously when I'm at home, I watch it on my watch.
Yeah, when you're at home, you got no choice,
I'm just saying in general, I couldn't spot things out. I mean, I didn't recognize
this. Is some good dialogue from John Lone right here. This is where he just blows off a little.
Well, because he knows, like, she's getting inside information. Now, when she mentions white powder ma,
white powder ma and the Thailand.
Yeah.
The Thailand visit.
You can tell he's panicking a bit.
But he handles it good, you know. He blows off steam, but yet he doesn't, you know, get totally pissed off.
He doesn't bat an eyelid, does he? I really like the fact that he kind of, like, you know, I mean, earlier, I think it was the scenes early on when he's kind of like, you know, when Joey Chai talks to the mayor talks to me, and you have to get off his back, and it's kind of like, holy shit.
Yeah, exactly.
This guy's like, you know, I mean, Mickey Rourke's kind of, as good as he is, he's not got the power to kind of take out this guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it ironically, kind of, the only way he does it is by, you know what I mean, the methods he does, like, by killing him, sort of thing. So he's not going to be able to do it.
I always like this scene, though, when she barges in.
It is a really good scene.
She's doing her run one, her model run.
Yeah, it is, you're right.
You know that? She's like, oh, yeah, Vogue magazine.
This is ridiculous. Oh, man.
Yeah, it's really bad acting.
It is ridiculous.
Like, I will say, yeah.
Get off the
phone. I need it an inch.
Yeah. Take a mile. But this is a scene that really kind of shows off the budget and the apartment and everything else.
No, yeah.
I mean, shit, man. You look at that, and that's actually real. I mean, these days they'd probably just CGI the bloody background in.
Oh yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, they wouldn't go to the extent of like hiring a huge building.
These days they'll CGI those two guys in the background, man.
Yeah, exactly.
They'll CGI all those pictures on the floor. They'll CGI all that, dude. Just don't have to bother. I mean, CGI artists are like a dime a dozen these days, you know. It's funny that he was just mourning his wife, and now he's back in business again.
Well, yeah, well, that's what you have to do in them situations. You just kind of get back on the fucking horse.
That's just when you know that the guy's, like, psychologically just obsessed with this, you know.
Well, he's not, now there's literally nothing else in his life. I mean...
Give him more motivation.
Exactly. I mean, Adriani's kind of in his life more to do with a kiss than anything else. You know what I mean? He's kind of like, he's just kind of got to know her because he kind of used her for the fact that she's a reporter and things like that.
Yeah. I like all the pizza boxes around and shit. You know, gives it a,
well, yeah, I know, especially because the apartment.
No, because you're hanging out with your friends or doing, you know, some shit, you have no time. You always have pizza boxes.
Well, no,
you know.
I think that's just a guy thing. I mean, because the
yeah, yeah,
the,
definitely the guy.
The place
thing,
is immaculate, and like she's come up to see that, she must have a fucking shit. She does anyway. She walks in, she's like, "What the fuck is going on here? That's a nightmare, man."
Yeah, she just goes straight to her room anyway. She doesn't even bother.
I know.
Yeah, I can't believe those ponies, man. Those are small, dude. That's like My Little Pony shit.
Yeah, I really like the speech here by Dennis Dunn, where he kind of mentions the sort of the history and all this stuff.
Yeah, this is another positive, you know, they're going on, you know, they're like, say something positive about the Chinese again.
Yeah. If I get sick, if I die, I'm fucked. My family's fucked.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Classic, man.
It's funny that you pointed that out the first time you mentioned that, because... I remember watching it with a girlfriend of mine, and she said the same thing. What the fuck is this guy talking about? If he's dead...
But as wrong as it is, literally, it makes a lot of sense.
It does make sense, man.
You know what he's saying. It's a kind of a funny line if you analyze it, but, I mean, you know what he means. You know what I mean? If he's making money for his family and everything, and, like, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
If he dies, then he's...
That's true.
Kind of he's talking in, like, the third person, you know what I mean? He's kind of, even though he's talking about himself, he's kind of saying, like, if I die, I'm...
Yeah, you know exactly. I mean? Basically, if he dies, then he's fucking it up for everyone, basically. Mm. I mean, it's just a combination of that and Oliver Stone writing screenplays while he's on coke.
Well, no, he was off coke at this point because he wrote Scarface when he was going cold turkey. I think he flew out. He was outside of I can't
remember. I doubt it, man. Come on, dude. I've read the same thing. I've read the same thing with cold turkey after Scarface, dude. But come on.
No, I didn't say when cold turkey. I said he wrote.
To come up with like JFK.
He wrote Scarface while he was doing cold turkey. I didn't say he hadn't gone back to cocaine. But anyway, we're not talking about Stone's coke addiction.
Yeah, that's true.
He's doing magic mushrooms when he's doing that.
Doing some crazy stuff. Yeah, coke was just. Yeah. Mm. He's moved on to better things. Stronger things.
That was a thing. I've never been able to get all this. I was reading loads of books back in the day, and I think I read one by Jane Hampshire, the producer of Narrowborn Killers, with John Murphy. And there's an article I was reading about Tarantino, his Narrowborn Killers script, and Oliver Stone obviously taking over it. And there was something about Year of the Dragon in that, but this is like long before I'd actually been like. This one was just when I was trying to track down Year of the Dragon before I'd actually seen it. And I can't remember the specifics because I haven't been able to find the book to do the research on it, but there was a bit mentioned about Quentin Tarantino kind of, like, first time he'd met Oliver Stone and kind of walked in and kind of said, all right, Oliver, blah, 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 and he just, like, laid into him about this certain scene in Year of the Dragon, saying, I really love your script for Year of the Dragon, but what the fuck was going on with that scene there when you wrote and blah, blah, blah. And I can't remember the scene he wrote, so it's kind of redundant me saying this, but he kind of, if anyone's able to track it down, find out what it is, then let me know. basically one scene he kind of says, and I'm really being interested to find out what scene he's talking about. And like, all of a sudden, kind of went off on one. Said, "Who the fuck are you talking to me about this?" You know what I mean? Like, I was in fucking Vietnam. Fuck off. You know what I mean? From Brazil.
Yeah.
It's like
just the whole Tarantino movie buff came out of him, you know?
Yeah, so, just kind of.
Like, now he hates him. Now, I mean, from what I understand, he just.
There was basically a point that being made where they said, like, Oliver Stone kind of said, "You make movies, whereas I make films," and it's kind of just like saying, like, I mean, what I make is kind of like art, whereas what you make is kind of entertainment. You know what I mean? Pretty much. And you, from one perspective, you kind of say that maybe, but like, I mean, it's kind of the art and business thing. You kind of have to. There's a thin line between it. But you kind of. You know what I mean? This is where they kind of they realize that like this guy might be a fucking wolf in sheep's clothing. I think. I mean, he's kind of he's taking on a bit too much. I think.
Yeah, in common. I mean, just young.
Yeah, this is another scene where you don't really need to risk in the subtitles because like I mean, it, pretty much what's being said, he's not that specific, and then obviously it gets referenced. The most specific bit is the fact the ship's coming in, and he doesn't get the name, and then it cuts back to Rock, and he's like, "The fucking name. We didn't get the name of the ship." You know what I mean?
Yeah, I specifically like this, I'll show you. It's the one guy with the glasses. You probably know what I'm talking about. It's the really calm guy with the glasses.
Zhang Cheng.
Is that, no, not that guy, the other guy. Oh. Not Victor Wong, not Zhang Cheng, but the other guy.
Right.
The guy just looks, he carries himself real well. It's the guy, where is he?
Yeah.
Far left.
Yeah. What about him?
He's very, he's just a really good portrayal of, like, a really,
Yeah, he's got a lot really, of talent. He's got a lot of dialogue, actually, as well.
He just looks like a powerful, Asian guy, a powerful Chinese guy. Looks like a believable, triad head.
Well, he's kind of like the main guy, other than Victor Wong and John Lone, as far as the dialogue is concerned and stuff. And I mean, the other guys, like, I think the two other guys in the scene probably couldn't even speak English.
Yeah.
So they just hired for the looks, you know what I mean? The guy with the pipe and with the
hat. Yeah, they just hired for the looks.
I mean, unless it is Zhang Cheng and he's doing a cameo, I don't know.
Never know, but yeah. Maybe it's low way.
Yeah, no, it's not low way. If it's low way, then it'd probably stink up the movie.
Yeah, it probably would. No, he'd be in his trailer gambling.
Well, yeah, exactly. He'd be betting on the horse. The fucking name
is. Look at the nuns.
Classic one. Classic. Now this scene here, man.
Crooked top, yeah.
Oh man, I don't know if you're familiar with Star Trek, but basically Star Trek, every time they have like a new character and it was going to get killed, they always wear a red t-shirt.
Are you serious?
And Dennis Dung may as well wear a red fucking t-shirt here when they go through the lineup, when they kind of like, when they're going through all the guys, when they realise someone's bugged the apartment, the restaurant. This bit here, wait for it, there you go. No, I mean, they're going down the line. Dennis Dung may as well have a red top on here saying, "I did it." You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly, dude.
It's like, what?
Yeah, this is a hard situation. Every time I see this scene, I kind of put myself in his position. And even right there, you can kind of tell.
Yeah, well, also, man, he stands out like a sore thumb. That's what I'm saying. He may as well have a red fucking Star Trek top on. You know what I mean? He's fucked. His family's fucked.
Yeah, no shit, dude.
He's like, oh, shit.
You know, the moment he gets whacked outside, they should start playing that Infatuation music by Rod Stewart again, dude. Every time she walks out of the Chinese guy, they just play the Rod Stewart music. That'd be hilarious.
This is a really good scene. Well, obviously, this is one of the scenes that shot in New York. I mean, I don't mean this one. I mean the one long shot here when the camera pulls back.
Yeah, this is a great scene, man.
But the guy behind him, you know what I mean? You kind of get a glimpse and think, oh, who's that guy from? And you're like, oh, fucking hell. And the way it's shot there is really good. I mean, when I took loads of stills for the photos, you can actually see the church that the nun looks out of actually reflected in the mirror when the gun's going off. It's kind of really well done. And it's just the way this is sort of done. I mean, I love the fact that he runs out over the thing and kind of gets the guy. And, like, you know, he's kind of spitting out the name and, like, Mickey Rourke kind of saying, you're going to be all right. And you're like, you're putting in. You know what I mean? His whole fucking face has been shot the shit
out. Exactly.
Which, I mean, really is.
Yeah, well, he knows he's going to die, but he might as well get used to it.
But that's just a really sort of, really good scene. The way they kind of say, like, I mean, it's a bit cliche, the kind of like.
I like the next scene coming up here. This really shows that it was made in 85, this next scene here with the club.
Yes, but I mean, at the end of the day, it's set in a club, and that's what.
It sounds like the music. I mean, if you're like in the UK, if you're like somewhere where you live and you walk into a club, this is what I picture right here.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we all went for club life.
I don't know, man. Is that what you guys do?
Yeah. I mean, I've never been to a club that big. But like I say, you can't really fault the music because it's set in 1985, and this music is 1985 music, and this is the club music. You know what I mean? But I really love this because, like, I mean, there's a different, two people in there. Yeah, there's three women taking drugs, two guys getting up to no good, you know what I mean? Finally,
is that what that was?
The
two
fags? I think so, yeah. Finally, like, they were finally found a fucking empty cubicle. Right,
you're back. Bruce Lilly,
fisting Bruce. Oh, shit, the fucking bad. Classic.
This is kind of cool. I like the fact that they, you know, it's the whole blowing up of the focus center.
Yeah, but when my mate was watching it, he said, what was that, silicon breast? I was like, what the fuck? Lots of been shot in the breast. I was like, A, like, silicon breasts weren't that popular then, and B, she hasn't got big breasts in the first place, and D, they're not going to blow up that together. It's like fucking...
That is a huge Asian club.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've never lived in
New York. Being in New York, I mean, even Chinatown, I figured it would be, mixed, but who knows, I've never been there, so...
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know, it depends on the night, 85. But that's one of the themes of the movie, is the fact that, like, the Asian culture... If you stay so sort of isolated from the outside world, like as in not having the police help you because the the guai lo, so to speak, that's kind of one of the themes, kind of saying like your culture kind of does that and you kind of stay so isolated, you become so vulnerable to kind of getting fucked from within by your own sort of, you know what I mean, leaders. That's why he's able to kind of go up through the ranks and kill off his father-in-law and everyone else and kind of take all the business because it's all like, I mean, no one's going to grass him up for the cops, you know what I mean, because it's all kind of, that's one of the sort of themes of the movie.
There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of scenes where Mickey Rourke's running out of a building or something where he breaks the glass and they're shooting at him. It happens three times in this movie. This is cool. This is dialogue, man. He tells it straight out.
Exactly. And you want to tell me before I go, sweetheart?
Yeah.
Fuck you. That's classic Oliver Stone.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I mean, even with, like, go fuck yourself and shit like that, it's like classic Oliver Stone.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's why what you said earlier is really true, you know, just the whole, you know, overblown dialogue, you know, Scarface and this, and then this is Oliver Stone written all over it. I mean, it's just too bad that, you know, Oliver Stone, I mean, I personally think Oliver Stone's a better script writer.
The director.
And movie director. That's just my thing, you know. I mean, that's just my thing. I mean, that's kind of, don't get me wrong, he's a good filmmaker, but he's a great, great writer.
Yeah, I can kind of agree.
But just like Tarantino, I mean, I don't think he's a good filmmaker,
it all depends on what,
writing, you know?
It all depends on what sort of movie you're making. I mean, because Oliver Stone was kind of like a writer for hire. I mean, this is based on a book. Scarface is kind of based on a previous movie, which was, I think was based on a book. Midnight Express based on a book, and like a lot of the scripts, Conan's based on the comic books, and a lot of stuff Oliver Stone wrote was kind of based on other material. The only stuff he's wrote off his own back was all his personal Vietnam trilogy, Platoon, Born the 4th of July, Heaven and Earth.
What about U-Turn?
I think that was the original screenplay. I don't think that was based on anything. Natterbound Killers is based on Tarantino's script.
So,
like, to be fair, a lot of the stuff that you're kind of giving him props for is kind of... He tends to be a good script writer of other people's work based on, like, previous, like, I mean, adapted screenplays.
This scene kind of reflects the whole scene in the diner, you know, where it's kind of moving up. This time he's the one who got fucked, you know, instead of Mickey Rourke, you know. Last time it was Wyatt and he's all emotional, this time it's him.
Yeah, you're right, actually. I never thought of that. But it really does.
It's showing both of the guys' downfalls. You know?
Yeah, just the way I really like the way the camera just kind of careens over them.
Even the facial expression John Lone is showing here, you know, he's like, oh god, dude, what the fuck?
Yeah,
man, from here on out,
they've lost faith in him, haven't they? The kind of like this young guy's kind of going to take the whole.
The joke. It's like he's the joke. He's like a joke. He's the big joke.
I mean, if he hadn't got killed, then they'd have probably whacked him out anyway. I mean, there might be. Once to find out.
If this was a Dolph Lundgren movie, he would be cutting off his fingers right now. But that's a Japanese yakuza.
Exactly. Sure, down little toes.
Dolph Lundgren movie, they would make the Chinese do that too.
Dolph Lundgren coming through the roof now and he'd pull his fucking huge dick out.
Yeah. You know, he'd come with his brown shorts and his high tops with no shirt on, dude. His Super Samurai outfit.
Yeah. And stab him with a sword that's not even straight.
Yeah, this is what this guy, this captain here, whoever this guy is, right?
Yeah, the
here.
Irish guy, yeah. This is the kind of character that's quite good.
Yeah, I'm not going to stop a whole ship just so you can search for drugs.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean,
makes a lot of sense, you know. It's too much trouble, and you're not going to stop.
Poking through 10,000 Edam chases.
Yeah.
Classic.
Look at the guy in the background, dude.
Yeah.
The continuity is real good. You know, you got the bandage on Mickey Rourke, and that guy got all fucked up. And any other action movie, they'd be like, you know, normal. They'd be walking in and out.
He's limping there not because he got shot. He's limping there because all the fucking fast food he's been eating. He's got indigestion. He's like, oh my god, grips are killing me. He's like, where's the toilet?
Now, what are these pills he's taking here? I used to put the birth control pills, right? Because he got raped. After morning pills or something. That's the only thing I explain, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never thought of it, actually. I don't know if they had morning after pills then.
Either that or aspirin or something, but it makes more sense that, you know, she got gang raped by a bunch of...
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose I never thought of it, really. I mean, obviously, there must be a point where otherwise they would just start...
Yeah, otherwise they wouldn't show it.
Enough, she'd have to
be... I like this dialogue here, man.
Yeah, this is actually... This is the one scene where she actually... She comes off really, like,
Oh, yeah, she does.
Yeah.
Well, pretty soon. It's when she starts, when she sits down.
Well, no, the whole scene, I mean, when she starts kicking off, when he kind of goes berserk on her and stuff, and just sits like, you know, a reporter, a whore.
Yeah, I got, I work for a paper, and I got a lot of reporter friends, of course, and I always use this line on them. Dude.
And they're going to give you
every time we're bullshitting, I say, what are you guys, reporters, you whore, the mean you guys will be a real reporter when you put your ass on the line.
Yeah,
and
they give you a blank look because they haven't seen the movie.
Yeah, they give you like, what?
Exactly, classic.
And then, you know, I keep on telling him, man, it's from Year of the Dragon, you should come over and watch.
And that's the
Mickey Rourke, there's no way I'm going to watch a Mickey Rourke movie, all right?
Oh, no. But you can't convince them. I mean, I do it all the time. I quote from so many movies, and people just give me these late looks as to what you talk about.
Yeah, there's like some of these movies they can watch. Why would they sit there and watch a Mickey Rourke movie?
Well, that's even the extent of my, like, close friends. I mean, I've gone, like, completely berserk and started watching even more obscure stuff, and, like, I'm quoting stuff that, I mean, no one else knows, and they're like...
People think, dude, I quote so many movies that people think I'm all...
But I don't do it...
I just do it. I don't give a shit.
I don't do it consciously, though. I just kind of... I think if I'm saying something, and I'll say something, and I'll realize it sounds like a movie, and I'll say it, and then I'll think, that was off such and such a movie.
But the thing is, personally, I don't realize it, man. If some of the stuff sounds good in movies, but when you say it in real life, man, you look like a total...
Well, it depends, man. I've had compliments for, like, speaking, like, I mean, oh, that's quite a good phrase. That's quite good. I'm like, it's all off a movie, you know what I mean? That's all made it up.
No, but when you're talking to a reporter and people are looking at you and you're asking, you, what are you, a reporter? You a whore? People are going to look at you like, what the fuck?
You're going to get sacked, man. Classic.
I mean, I wish I could record some of the stuff I say to these guys, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is where she's really good right here.
Hmm. Actually, remind me on, I've got something to say about the very end scene on the railways. When the railway comes, I just can't forget.
Okay.
I've been keeping stuff for the end, and I'm probably going to forget the
stuff. I'm surprised your phone has a ring up.
You shouldn't have said that, now you've jinxed it.
I don't believe in jinxing, man.
Alright, okay. You make your own luck, don't you?
Yeah, she's good in this part too, where he turned around.
And... Yeah. I'll tell you what's quite good as well, coming up. You know the bit where the guy who goes past in the car goes, Stanley, where are you, cocksucker?
And shoots at him. Piece of shit. Is this a cocksucker or a piece of shit?
Well, I always wondered who he was when the first couple of times I watched. I was like, where did this guy come from? Where is he? And he's like, I mean, he's the guy who kind of, he's working for Joey Ty.
Yeah.
And you kind of see him at the end where he says, oh, the place is bugged out and stuff. Oh, I forgot about this scene. We've got this scene coming up, haven't we?
Yeah, I know. I thought I was going to jump right to the pier, too.
This is like kind of...
It's funny how the blood is still red. That's like another goof, you know?
Yeah, because it turns
blood
black.
It turns really reddish-black after
a while. Well, it turns black. That's one thing. Wild Bunch, Sam Peckinpah, after the shootout scene for that, I mean, there was blood scattered everywhere and stuff from all the squibs going off, and then that shoot all the aftermath, and Sam Peckinpah was like, well, what are you going to do? You're going to get rid of the blood, and the light's already there. So he goes, it turns black after the fucking oxygen touches it. He's like, what? Well, you want us to change all that blood black? He's like, yeah. So they, like, clean the blood up, put it all down black. Whereas it just doesn't get done in, like, most movies, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Especially Shaw Brothers movies. I mean, I've been watching, like, loads of them.
Oh, yeah, man.
The blood in that's, like, redder than red.
The outfits are, like, tied with bleach.
Yeah, redder than
red. And then the fucking blood is, like, red on, like, pure new white, man.
Exactly.
Those are the Chinese Super Ninjas, man. You gotta love the whole, it's, like,
I
so
kinda
much
wait,
bleach and white.
I can't wait till that comes out on Celestial.
Yeah, I think it's going to come out sooner than you said, man. Nah, I think it's going to come out sooner than you think.
Wouldn't hold your breath.
I mean, at least in a couple of years, at least. Which
it won't be out this year, I don't think. Anyway.
Yeah.
Actually,
they're not going in order. That's for sure. I think they're just kind of going. Randomly choosing some of the popular ones.
Anyway, if we kind of get back on topic slightly, I was going to mention a lot of the similarities between this and Live and Die in L.A. I mean, I haven't really kind of had the opportunity to kind of mention them other than the fact that they're both made in, like, 1985 and they both kind of deal with, like really sort of cops who kind of go above and beyond duty to kind of get a job done sort of thing. But what did I find out when I was doing research is that one of the main actresses in Live and Die in L.A., called Deborah Fuhr, and she was actually did a movie with Mickey Rock called Homeboy a couple of years later, and they actually got married for a couple of years until obviously he split up or whatever, and he's married to the Wild Orchid chick, whoever she is.
Yeah, the Wild Orchid.
Sorry, Carrie Otis.
Yeah.
I tell you about this scene, obviously, when they're swapping
the. It was also the downfall. The moment he married her was the big downfall, too, man.
Yeah, well, it was obviously
that's when he started boxing, he started doing God knows what.
Now, this scene here, when you see the Lamborghini, they'd either been milked to death. You can imagine this was directed by Michael Bay. You'd have, like, about 50 cameras on, like, slow-mo, like, looking up at the Lamborghini stuff going by. Well, they're just kind of thrown away in this. It's kind of like, oh, three Lamborghinis, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty cool.
Well, it's Michael Cimino, man. It's like, he gives a fuck, you know? Like you said, if it was someone else, it'd be like, ooh.
I mentioned Taxi Driver.
If it was someone else, maybe he'd be driving. That would be a Lamborghini right there.
Yeah. Actually, I mentioned Taxi Driver early, and he gets shot in the hand as well.
I know. I wonder if it's some sort of a homage.
Maybe. Got the gear on here. Stanley White, you cocksucker.
Yeah, this is where the black guy gets shot in the hand, too, or something. No, it goes through his hand.
He goes through his hand and kills the other guy.
Yeah.
Shoots him in the face.
This is where he should have had the knife in his
right. Teeth. Actually, right, this is the original ending. I don't know what the ending is like in the book, but Oliver Stone's... Oliver Stone's original ending, right? let me get this out before I finish. Oliver Stone's original
ending
was actually going to be when Joey Chai comes back in the country, he gets Mickey Rourke kind of catches him for... he tries to bring his wife back or something, and he kind of gets him done as a bigamist. And that was kind of the original ending until Dino De Laurentiis said, no, I want this shootout on the railway docks. And I was like, really? So I was like, okay, so that was kind of a Dino De Laurentiis kind of change.
Oh, really? So it was supposed to end the moment he runs away, right?
Well, no, like, when he comes back, he kind of gets arrested, and he kind of catches him, like, lawfully, and he kind of gets arrested for being a bigamist and put away for, like, having two wives or whatever. I was kind of really, like, surprised to sort of read that. I was like, I also find it quite ironic that you get the big speeches in the movies about the Chinese building the railways. And, like, the fucking railway in the movie kind of fucks him up. And if that railway wasn't there, he'd have been able to get away, because the train wouldn't have come out.
Right, he dies. And, you know, when they say 1,000 people died building the railroads,
I mean, I'll read that.
I never even thought about that. That's kind of a cool thing.
I thought of it when I about the second time watching it. I was like, oh, it's a really kind of good sort of analogy. And it's like a really, really good scene. I mean, the cinematography is beautiful. I mean, when he's running away in the distance, it looks like he's on a stairway to heaven. Kind of like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we were talking about the poster, you know, we were like, oh, it's really, I mean, if it was that movie made in the 90s, they would have used that for the poster.
Yeah. I mean, that's quite funny, because you actually used this picture from the press kit on the actual site, didn't you? And, like, no, I mean, it's not so much a spoiler, but...
Oh, yeah, this picture right here,
you know what I mean? But if you'd seen that still, and you were seeing it just before watching the movie, you'd kind of be waiting for the thing the whole movie, wouldn't you? And it is...
Yeah, that's right.
And I was like, no, I mean... If I'd have seen the movie, for instance, I'd have said don't use that on the front page because it's kind of a bit of a giveaway, but you don't really notice some things until you've kind of seen the movie. I mean, I think it's a really good ending, the way he kind of, like, gives him the gun sort of thing. And a lot of people have said, like, well, I mean, it's a bit... I mean, he's been such a snake the whole movie, he's surprised he didn't shoot Mickey Rourke. But it's kind of like, I mean, it's a really kind of honourable death. I mean, with a lot of the Asian sort of movies have that, I mean, especially the Japanese, where they're kind of...
The way Mickey Rourke sees it, man, I mean, you don't know Mickey Rourke. The way Stanley White sees it is... I mean, if this guy was to get arrested, anything could happen, you know. This guy is so powerful that he could probably get out and, you know, get the best lawyer and get out, so, you know,
actually. I wish the movie had kind of ended pretty much there. I don't really like these scenes after the fact where he's kind of like, you know, I mean, he's kind of knackered now. He's being shot off the force and the new guy's kind of taking over and it's kind of the same shit's going to happen, so to speak. And it's kind of like, it doesn't wind up the movie. It kind of just kind of drags on a bit. I think it'd have been better if it had kind of ended on, like, the last sort of scene, it kind of just kind of like, I don't know. You need, probably need a different scene and stuff, but just this feels a bit like unnecessary. And the scene at the end, we're coming up to where Adriani kind of like grabs him and stuff when he kind of speaks to him and stuff. It just seems a bit strange somehow. I don't know. I mean, do you like the ending?
I like the ending a lot.
Yeah.
Especially when it just freeze frames on the two, it kind of gives it.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look flipping through channels and you just see that scene, it kind of resembles like a World War II movie.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, I'll show you what I mean when it gets there. It kind of looks like a war movie in a way.
Yeah. I mean, it works.
You'll see what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it works in the sense the scene it looks good and it's well shot and it kind of works, but it just doesn't seem to work in the flow of the movie. Just every time this kind of scene comes up now, it's kind of like I'm like wanting to kind of just like eject the disc and kind of it's over. You know what I mean? It's
oh, really?
It just seems a bit
during this scene or during the last scene, during the last frame.
This scene's all right, but it kind of doesn't really go anywhere. You know what I mean? He kind of gets jumped on and he kind of gets beat down and he's on the.
You want more, right? You kind of like want more. And it is Kung Fu Gallagher, man. That guy's been in a lot of movies too. He was like the Asian guy of the late 80s, early 90s. You know, right. He was in every action movie.
Bolo. It's surprising, isn't it?
Yeah, there's Bolo right there, dude.
Oh, right, yeah, it is, isn't it? No, what's the guy called? I recognize him.
Which guy?
What did you say he was called? The guy who jumped over the thing, you know about? Who's in all the movies?
Kung Fu Gallagher?
What's his name?
Kung Fu Gallagher. Well, I call him Kung Fu Gallagher. That guy's actual name is...
He looked like Conan Lee, actually. I want to see him there. I know it isn't, but I mean...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know. They kind of look like him. You never know. Conan Lee was in Big Trouble in China, so...
Shit, yeah, I might check it out, actually. Do a rewind once I'm finished.
See, they're going to freeze frame, and it kind of looks like the end of some kind of World War, you know, some war movie epic of some sort. It
looks like someone bullet in the head.
There's like these two black guys that just kind of stare at him towards the end.
Hmm. All right, they're just bad actors, actually. Wandering on the wrong set,
like
come down.
They look like they have epilepsy or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like...
Yeah, what are they doing, I mean? Is it DMX or someone?
Yeah, DMX.
Right, I think we've got about 15 minutes of credits here, so I mean, we don't really have to wind up or anything, but like, I can't believe I actually got the movie out of the way. I was expecting the phone to go off at some point. But yeah, well, that was basically the Year of the Dragon.
I like the fact that they use what's the song called? The Wind, the Dance? Dream Dance.
Dream Dance.
I like the fact that they use in the credits, kind of a nice touch, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was out of that, or the opening theme, I suppose, as far as like kind of finishing it on. Whatever. I mean, yeah, it's okay. I mean, I like the way they kind of bring in the picture and move it across.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's pretty much summed up everything I kind of planned to say. Have you got anything else you forgot to mention?
No, I think that pretty much sums it up.
I think we did all right, considering it was a 2 hours, 15-minute movie.
Yeah.
Wasn't too many
strings. I'm still waiting for a sequel, man, you know? Mm. Giant Fact, your next...
Well, yeah, I suppose like a Corruptor and stuff. I mean, it's interesting because I haven't seen the...
Yeah, that's right, the Corruptor, yeah.
So. I haven't seen the Corruptor and the other sort of...
You've never seen it?
No, I haven't seen it since I've watched Year of the Dragon.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Because you kept saying to me, like, oh, yeah, so-and-so-and-so is quite similar to this. And
yeah, they're alike. The two movies are alike. You can tell that, you know, this is one of the movies that inspired the whole Corruptor thing.
Yeah. I mean, I was on...
I'm not just saying that because Chang and Fat sings a song at the beginning either. I mean, it's just really
like... Well, it deals with the NYPD...
The
only difference is the fact that Mike Wahlberg's a kind of an up-and-coming guy who's kind of coming in and showing Fat players a kind of a bit of a corrupt copper in it, where Stanley White, although he's not corrupt, he's kind of a bit, like, goes above and below, above and beyond duty. It's kind of for thrill and stuff.
This, if you want to download the song, it's available, well, it will be available on the site.
Yeah, I've ripped it off DVD.
When we get all this stuff together,
I suppose we could mention that now anyway, because by the time people have been listening...
And a lot of this stuff will be on the site too, everything, but obviously if you download this MP3 of this file, then obviously...
Yeah. And you can get this DVD from Hong Kong Flicks or...
Yeah, HongKongFlicks.com, and hopefully you'll have better access to it once it reaches, you know... domestically here in the US.
I mean, as much as it is...
Don't hold your damn breath.
Exactly. I mean, as much as it's a Region 3 DVD, it's pretty much an American...
Yeah, it's pretty, yeah.
The only thing that makes different from a standard, like, vanilla release on Region 1 is the fact that it's encoded mm-hmm. Region 3, or encoded Region 3 and Region 4.
Exactly.
So, I mean,
and then, speaking of which, it's one of the great ones, one of the really good, well-done produced DVD, too. I mean, it looks really good.
Well, yeah, it is. It's flawless. I mean, I don't think it's been remastered.
Despite the lack of...
You often find that's the case with movies that have been, like, buried, because what's happened is, like, this came out, and it's kind of hasn't been that successful, and it's kind of just died.
Yeah.
And their technical police consultant, Stanley White. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw that. I mentioned that. It may be just, it could be real. It might have been just an unrunning joke.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the guy in the book isn't called Stanley White. He's called someone completely
different. Yeah, he's called his Powers, I think. Something Powers.
And obviously, it's kind of a... I mean, it's interesting that the guy's called Stanley White, and the guy in King of New York, Christopher Walken, is called Frank White. I mean, the only thing that's interesting about that is the fact Joey Ching plays the same character in both movies, but
yeah.
It's another one with a white. We're kind of coming to the end of this, I think. I don't know. We've got a couple more seconds, have we? A
couple more seconds. Armani, there you go.
Yeah.
She's found an Aryan.
Model.
Yeah, but I consider this. I mean, it's no, just like you said in your review. It's no, it's no classic per se, but it's definitely entertaining.
Well, I'd go as far as saying it's a classic.
Entertaining, man.
A classic of its
time. I mean, it's well made. Yeah,
it is. Anyway.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, this is the Jizzer signing off for Seat on Fire.
And MPM as well.